from the Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago in Inglewood, Pastor Andre Brooks, children's author Giselle Potter, and live music from Bethany Thomas. And now, here's your host, a man who is also making his 2005 tax returns available, Justin Kaufman.
I hope you guys can read the 1040 easy. I don't know. I don't want to make a big deal about it, but I did the front and the back. It's a one-pager. It's a pink one. Oh, a simpler day. I remember one time I did my taxes when I was maybe in, I would say this is probably in the 90s, mid-90s. It was like maybe 20, 21 years old, and I was doing the 1040 easy, and you did it at the last minute, right? And I had nothing except a W-2, right? That was about it. Barely, you know, cracking 20 grand. And I remember I did it, it was like April 15th, and I had to meet somebody up at Shuba's for a show or something like that. And so I took my tax returns with me to the show. Like, it was like a kind of a thing. And I remember this so vividly. And I don't know if they do this anymore, but there were huge, like, I don't know if it was because it was Lakeview. It was just a huge place for 20-year-olds, 21, 22-year-olds. But there were these huge bins, like canvas bins that people were standing there with, like, get your taxes and just put it in here. It was like just a bunch of kids coming up and just dropping their tax forms. And, you know, they got to be with a stamp on them and everything. But it was like, that's what you did. Like, it wasn't, you didn't put it in the blue post office, the box on the corner. This was just like, almost like air traffic controllers, like, throw them here, guys. Throw them here, lazy. Throw them here, Mr. 20-year-old. I was like, oh, yeah.
It's like they should have had the news over there, because that's a big local news story every April 15th at midnight.
Like, yeah.
You know, the car is driving by and somebody out there collecting
that's
their last
what it was like. Had. And I feel like that image it's burned in my head, because I was always like, wow, this is crazy. I'm never going to be this late again. I probably have been. But it was amazing to me that I have not seen that since. Like, yeah. I never see that. And it was just, I was up by Shuba's. I just remember it being like at Belmont area. I was like, oh. Perfect.
This is great.
I was going to hold on to these all night. Yeah. You know? When the band was over, I'd go find a post office, but this is so convenient. Good evening, everybody. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. It's a great, you know, it's a Wednesday, March 15th, and we've got you covered tonight. Coming up, Pastor K. Andre Brooks is going to join us. We're going to talk a little bit about Chicago violence, gun violence, and talk about what the church can do. Pastor Brooks is part of a church in Inglewood, and we want to talk about the role of the church, the role of faith, but also the role of the church when it comes to changing the narrative. Inglewood is on a mission to let everybody know in the Chicago area that it's not just one big gang fight, that there is a lot going on in that neighborhood. There are positive storylines and news stories that are coming out, and a lot of times the news is only interested in victims. So we'll talk with Pastor Brooks about what it takes to do a church, what it takes to sort of be in a position where you are a leader in an area that is affected by violence. So we'll talk with Pastor Brooks coming up as well. Mike Fouché is going to join us at 7:30. We'll talk about some of the things that are happening that are around violence, including Chicago police reforms, department reforms, introduced by Superintendent Johnson, a 27-page report essentially saying that we're going to do this. You just wait. We're going to do this. Essentially, that was 27 pages of that. Also, we'll talk about the summer jobs program that Mayor Emanuel is at the helm. And I'm really interested in this story. I really like it. So we'll talk with Mike Fouché coming up at 7:30, his regular Wednesday night check-in. Also, tonight, this is cool. Children's author Giselle Potter is going to join us. Giselle Potter is a tremendous, tremendous illustrator and writer. She did the book The Year I Didn't Go to School, which is a very classic, I think it's 15, 20 years old now, on everybody's shelf children's book. And she lives in upstate New York. And she's in town because the Children's Theater of Chicago, Chicago Children's Theater, is putting on a stage version of her book. And it's the Actors Gymnasium and Heidi Stillman, the artistic director at the Looking Glass Theater. They're taking it. It was one of Heidi's favorite books. And she is putting it to stage, and it's on stage at the Ruth Page Center right now. So we'll talk to them about that concept, about taking a children's book and adapting it to stage. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, Bethany Thomas is here. Bethany Thomas, one of Chicago's most versatile musicians. She has a month-long residency at the Hideout right now. She is coming in, bringing her guitar player. She can play some songs, but she's doing this residency, really Robbie Folk spot on Monday nights. And it's great. One night she does full Linda Ronstadt. Next night's Lou Reed. She's got an EP coming out, so she's got a record release party coming out. She's great. You know, she's not only a musician, but she's a talented actress. She's been in so many plays and theaters here in Chicago, so she's sort of a double threat. Probably a triple threat. I just don't know what the third thing would be, but guarantee she's talented. She was in here. She sang with John Langford. When John Langford was in here not too long ago, so it was fun to have her. So she's back. Excited about that. And, of course, tonight, you guys, a swap meet. Greg Flamm is back. I can't tell you, last week was one of my favorite swap meets of all time. So many people called up about World War I and World War II memorabilia. I got one listener, I can't remember his name, he reached out to me, and he's like, I want to tell the story about the casino chips from Al Capone's underground casino. He has chips from it, and there's a story attached. He's like, I didn't get a chance to tell a story. I'm like, oh my God, call in this week. So hopefully he'll call back tonight so we can find out where he got the chips, what's the story behind. Essentially, you know, Al Capone had casinos all around the south side of Chicago, and he's got some of the chips that he somehow inherited or received over the years. So that's coming up. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman, of course. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's get this show on the road, shall we? Let's start with the carryout. This, of course, nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. You know what, though? You know what? Let's not do it this way. Let's do it different tonight. You know what? Everyone's really at the end of their rope, cramming to get their brackets in for the big dance that starts tomorrow, March Madness. Why don't we go ahead and bring you the carryout bracket edition? This is the bracket challenge. Why don't we do this? Why don't we take today's top stories? We'll take 16 of them and we'll pit them against each other in two different categories to bring you this day's best news story at the end. Shall we? What do you think? Let's do it. All right. Why don't we start in the East? The number one seed versus the eight. The number one seed has to be the debacle over Trump tax returns. Maddow had them, but the White House did too. And they're from 2005, and no one cares, but everybody blames everyone, right? And at the end of the day, maybe Trump leaked it himself because that's something you do as president. All right. So that's the number one seed. I think I like that. The number eight seed, I have to say spiders, who eat over 880 million tons of insects a year. Yeah, this is a story, a study that came out that says spiders eat over 880 million tons of insects a year. That's a great story, and I think it's important probably because there's a need for insects to be eaten. But I have to say the number one seed moves to the second round. Let's do Trump tax returns into the Elite Eight. All right, let's go down to the four and five seed. In the four seed, we've got the House Intelligence Committee chair saying he doesn't believe that the Trump Tower was hacked. They've been asking and asking for the information. The information has not been there. The House Intelligence Committee chair said, you know what? I just don't believe it. Not a good story for Donald Trump, of course. In the number five seed, I would say let's make it local. The James Beard Awards announced today, the big Oscars for the food community. It's done here right in Chicago. Some in the food community say that Chicago didn't do very well, that they were somewhat snubbed. Scandal. House Intelligence Committee Chair moves on, right? Let's do no hacking. We'll put that. No hacking moves on to the Elite Eight. Let's do the three and the six. Yahoo, the big hack, the email hack that we heard about last month. Well, some people have been charged, indicted. It turns out they were Russian spies. What? Russian spies are hacking my Jakoff's 2003 account? Not cool. They're going to get at my Flickr account. I'm worried. I want to make the number six seed, the new Yahoo CEO, Melissa Mayer, of course, stepping down or being replaced. The new Yahoo CEO, who will be taking over for Yahoo, will make double what Melissa Mayer made. Can you guess what gender the new CEO is? That's right, everybody. It's a male. I mean, Melissa Mayer is considered one of the most successful and well-known CEOs in American history. Maybe she didn't do a great job at Yahoo, but the idea that the next person that comes in, a relative no-name, gets double because he's a man, I think the six is an upset. Yeah, I think we go with the number six, new Yahoo CEO. Moves on. All right. And then at the bottom in the east, we've got the two. The Fed increase today, which is, you know, because the economy's going to grow more with more interest rate, or at least credit cards will charge more in interest, which, let's face it, that's what politicians mean when they say the economy will grow. Banks are going to get more money. That's essentially what that is. And hopefully they'll trickle it down. Right. So the Fed increase today versus the number seven. Matrix reboot in the works. Keanu Reeves saying he would be up for it. The rest of the world saying, aren't we living it? Isn't that what we're doing right now? I don't know if we need a movie to take us out of the Matrix that we're actually in. But the Fed increase moves to the next round. So there we go. So in the East, we've got Trump tax returns. We'll be versus the no hacking scandal. New Yahoo CEO getting double what Melissa Mayer got. And the Fed increase. Let's go to the West, shall we? We'll go to the West. The number one seed has to be the travel ban put on hold at the last minute by a judge in Hawaii. Trump has no luck with Hawaii. You know, he really doesn't. First the birth certificate, now the travel ban. Nah! The eighth seed, you know what? This is a big one. The Brauhaus, the famed German restaurant in Lincoln Square, said to be closing after 40 years. There's still questions of whether or not that story is legitimate. 40 years in business, no end date has been set, and there hasn't really been much comment from the ownership. But that place is tremendous, and I remember going in there and dropping a lot of $5 bills to get the band to play Lady in Red late on a Saturday night. You know what? I hate to do this, but I got to say the first upset of the night. Brauhaus moves on. We're going to hear so much about the travel ban later. Brauhaus is a bigger story today. The 4 and 5, Rex Tillerson goes to Asia. He's the number 4. The big story there, though, he doesn't bring pool reporters. He takes one reporter, and it's from a conservative website. I just, to me, I got to say, I'm like, I'm just trying to think of like if Hillary Clinton just took Daily Kos, right? And that was it. Or Uncut America, or Occupy Dems. No, they're good. We'll take Occupy Dems. They're coming with me to Libya to do this story. We would freak out. But somehow it's not on the other side. So that's a big story. Number 5, this new study, a new poll comes out and says that Governor Rauner here in the state of Illinois and Speaker Mike Madigan, they are both unpopular equally. Huh. There you go. That's good, I guess. They're hated on the same level. That's great. You know what? I'm going to go with Tillerson just for the fact that everybody knew that already about Rauner and Madigan, right? Moves on to the next round. And then the 3 and 6 tonight, we've got summer jobs, the big story of Mayor Emanuel getting 31,000 summer jobs available for Chicago youth versus a story that I saw about a lawsuit settled over sex toy spying. Because there's some apps that will help you sort of with the frequency of your sex toys, how fast they are, how slow they are. And that app was acquiring data that was illegal, allegedly. So unless maybe they were doing more nefarious things like spying on you actually with a camera, but I don't think that was happening. It was really about data. But just for the gross out factor, we'll stay with summer jobs. And the 2 and 7, police reforms, which you don't know much about yet, versus injuries, Anisimov out 3 to 4 weeks. Also, Charlie Tilson, the center fielder for the Chicago White Sox, really his rookie season. Everyone's excited. He will start the season on the DL with a foot injury. I think we'll stay with police reforms, though, just to keep hope springs eternal when it comes to sports. All right, let's get to the Elite Eight here. Are we ready? Are we ready to go back to the East, Pete?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Trump tax returns versus the House Intelligence Committee chair saying that there doesn't believe to be a Trump Tower hack. It's a tough one. I mean, I think the tax returns probably is a bigger story, but at the same time, there's nothing there. There's no meat. Also, please check your feed before you make a Geraldo Rivera Al Capone joke. Right? How many did you see that you're like, did you not just read the person who was right next to you doing the same exact thing? Read the feed, then write the joke. Too much jumping into that. I would say just for that, let's go with no hacking. No hacking moves on to the final four. Trump tax return next. On the bottom, we've got the new Yahoo CEO making twice the woman CEO, Melissa Mayer, that he's going to be replacing versus the Fed increase. I don't know. I think the bigger story tonight is the Yahoo CEO. I don't know how they can even do that with all that's happened in the world in the last 6 months, from the Women's March to other places. Melissa Mayer is a big deal, to come in and say, we're going to double the salary from the next guy. Would they have doubled it if it was a woman? I don't know, man. I don't like that one, and I think that's salacious enough to make it to the Final Four. So the new Yahoo CEO moves to the Final Four. All right, on the other side, we got the Brauhaus versus Rex Tillerson. Brauhaus goes to the Final Four. And then, of course, the summer jobs versus police reforms. Let's go summer job. I love that story, and we'll talk more with Mike about that coming up. So now we got the Final Four tonight. We've got the no hacking story versus the new Yahoo CEO, or we've got the Brauhaus versus summer jobs. Oof. No hacking versus the new Yahoo CEO. I have to say no hacking. That's a big story. The House Intelligence Committee really need to side with the president on that one. The fact that they went out of bounds, a Republican-led House Intelligence Committee, not a good start for President Trump in sort of, you know, coming up with the proof from his tweet earlier this month. On the other side, the Brauhaus versus summer jobs. Ugh. I'm going to go with summer jobs only because I feel like the busboys and waiters that work at the Brauhaus have a fallback now that the Brauhaus is out.
Nice little run, though, for
Final Four for an eight seed. That's pretty good. So the final tonight, the big two stories in our bracket challenge to carry out here on March 15th. We've got the House Intelligence Committee chair saying he does not believe there was hacking of the Trump Tower versus summer jobs in Chicago. Summer jobs in Chicago. I think that's the biggest story. I think it means a ton to Chicago, and we'll talk more about that coming up. So there it is. See, we could do this too. I hope this inspired you to come up with better or at least more efficient ways to do your brackets this March Madness. Rob Martyr, you doing a bracket this year?
Yeah. Done. I had the Brauhaus going all the way. I don't know what you do. Summer jobs programs, women getting paid less. I don't know what you're talking about. The Brauhaus, I had it in the final.
I know, right? I feel like there's a second guess there. I feel like I'm second guessing myself. Hey, if it was the actual day that the Brauhaus was closing doors and not just sort of like the announcement that sometime in the future, I think they'd go all the way. It's an early program. They got a lot of freshmen there.
I hear you.
No, next year, maybe
it's
next time.
It's valid. I mean, they were what, a four seed?
They were an eight seed.
They were an eight seed.
They beat the travel ban.
Gotcha. Hey, if you'll indulge me just for about 2 seconds here. Today, I had the distinct pleasure of being out at my high school, my former high school, Glenbrook South in Glenview. They had a career fair day today. They do this every other year out there. I was invited. This is the first year that I've done it. I had four full sessions. So I'd like to thank all the kids that came through and, you know, listened to me carry on about the industry and my career and you know, possibly helping them out and whatnot. So it was a great day. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Did you do the classic you know what? For every one of you, there's 100 people that want this job.
I didn't go fire and brimstone. I said that the industry is competitive. I said be prepared to hear the word no a lot. they were smart kids. They asked great questions. We had a lot of fun. So,
all right,
thanks
good man. I wish I had my high school, Rob Martyr. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, all right. It was fun. So thanks again.
Thank you, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman.
What do I have to do to get some peppier music?
No way, man. I like this music.
Man.
Right, it's Childish Gambino, first of all.
And, no, he's cool.
And second of all, it's Gritty City, man.
Comedian
and that's what we're talking
to rapper.
About.
I mean,
Yeah, no, but I just like
I know
that
that's
feel,
what you aspire
feel,
to.
The feel of like...
When are you going to drop beats? Yeah, that's great.
Like we're, we're doing the show and from the Hill Street Blues police station.
Yeah.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday to talk about the issues facing our community, political stuff mostly. Let's talk about, let's start with the CPD reforms tonight. Really interesting. Superintendent Johnson, like yesterday, kind of.
All of a sudden.
All of a sudden.
And he says, we're going to have a press conference at 4:15. First off, who has press conferences at 4:15? Because what's happening at 4:15 is all the news stations have started their afternoon news. So you're not going to get a big play in it. And it's usually pretty late for the deadlines for the newspapers.
Yeah, this kind of snuck in.
It was kind of
right.
a weird
yeah.
time, you know? And, you know, whatever. Hey, man, you do you. So, you know, the press conference was interesting. It was in a small room. It wasn't in the typical big room that they have for press conferences. And it was the police superintendent along with the chair of the police board, Lori Lightfoot, which is very, very significant because Lori Lightfoot has been incredibly very, very critical of the police department and the Emanuel administration. Even though she's part of the Emanuel administration, she's been critical of them of not coming up with enough reform fast
She
enough.
Came up with the report that was before the Department
Police
of Justice report.
Task Force.
Right, right.
Yeah, and actually was around now a year ago mm-hmm. when the task force report came out.
Now, Mike, I mean, the obvious question, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, politically, the Department of Justice and the consent decree and the idea that, you know, the waves of change are in Washington, D.C., and it may not be that important to
right.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions to push reform on a Chicago Police Department.
Right.
Why is the police department going out of their way yeah. to talk about reforms when that's still unsettled?
Well, they still have a few problems that they have to take care of. I mean, they have a credibility issue. And they've got credibility issue on a couple of things. And what's interesting about this reform package, and I heard you talking in the promo before earlier, 27 pages. What's interesting of all those 27 pages is again and again and again, they say, these are things that our officers have asked for. And so the things that they talk about, they have increased transparency, which includes a new telephone number for police officers to call and make anonymous tips about reporting problems with other officers. They are spending, they say that they're going to be spending a lot of money and energy onto improving the training and the in-service training. So after you've graduated from the academy, and also changing the curriculum and improving the curriculum at the police academy. Two things that were brought up both by the DOJ report and the Police Accountability Task Force report. They also say that they're going to be improving their community policing program, that they have a new group that they're going to be consulting. It's made up of people from the community that will be telling them how they can improve community policing, which is something that was raised by both the DOJ report and the Police Accountability Task Force report. You know, it's interesting, the training and community policing, those are both things that a lot of officers have been talking about.
Training especially. Yeah.
Training especially, and saying that they want more training and that they want to improve.
And this is important because this is an issue that I think when people hear training, they think that police officers are in the current situation untrained. And that's not the case.
It's not true.
We found this out from the Department of Justice, too, that, you know, we're talking about training methods that have been somewhat started in the 1970s and 80s, and that's how they train
right,
officers.
Right.
And the officers are saying, for me to be able to do the job that it takes to be a police officer in 2017, you can't show me the video from 1974 on how to catch a perp.
Every professional has to have some sort of update training that they do. You know, accountants get it, lawyers get it, architects get it, and even tradesmen. You know, you talk to plumbers, you talk to carpenters, they have to go back every couple of years, you know, oh yeah, I got to learn about this new tool or this new thing that they're doing, new kind of windows that they put in. You know, everybody has to get training as they go along, and police officers in Chicago have not really been kept up to speed with the things that they want. And guys on the beat have been saying, this is something we want. This is something we need. We don't feel like we've been getting enough of it.
Right.
Now, what's really interesting is that if you read the report is really written very much like, this is what the police want. This is what the police want. This is what the police want. It makes a few references to the DOJ report and the Police Accountability Task Force report, but it's mostly
about officers.
About officers. Now, you know what's going on
yes,
right now.
This is really intriguing.
So the
FOP election,
the Fraternal Order of Police, they just had their election and it's done by mail and the votes were just tabulated last week. And now it's going to a runoff between the president, Dean Angelo, and a challenging group led by a guy named Kevin Graham. They have a group called Blue Voices, and Blue Voices is they reject the DOJ report. They reject the Police Accountability Task report. They say that you should be much, much more stringent in dealing with the negotiations for the upcoming police contract. They say that Angelo has been too soft and he has been giving things away to the police department and to the mayor's office. And, you know, I think that the police department brass are very concerned that Kevin Graham could actually win. Now, they're going to have a runoff election, and the election, the votes just went out today, and they're going to be tabulated on March
29th. The theory that you're talking about would be that the police department put this out at this time to help or support the incumbent.
The incumbent, Dean Angelo. Who, interestingly enough, he was elected for the first time 3 years ago in a runoff election.
Yeah.
So it's
and
not
to his
like
defense, I read the article. They said there's 8 or 9 people run for that, so it's hard to get a 50% anyway.
Yeah,
right?
But you know, Angelo's percentage was pretty low. I mean, he was at about 38%, and the other guy, Kevin Graham, was at about 24%. So,
when is the election for that? That's coming up.
So the ballots just went out in the mail today, and then they're going to be tabulated on March 29th.
Interesting. We'll pay attention to that. Mike Fouché in studio. He's from the Daily Line. He joins us every Wednesday. We'll come back. Let's talk summer jobs, shall we?
Yeah.
So download here on 720 WGN, Mike Fouché in studio from the Daily Line, breaking down this week's news.
Listen, man, I know that you were talking about the Brauhaus before, and I've got an amazing Brauhaus story.
Okay, bring it on.
I was talking to the two brothers, one of the two brothers, Harry and Gunther Kempf.
Classics.
And yeah, I know. And they've got like
with the mullet, the one guy's got the mullet.
And they've got the German accent and all that stuff. And
so good.
He was telling me that one of the brothers had come over from East Germany. And one of the brothers had come over before the wall went up.
Whoa.
And started working in restaurants in Chicago. And so then he started working. I guess he was running the Brauhaus or owning the Brauhaus or something. And so then his other brother literally swam across the River Elbe in from East Germany into West Germany in order to escape. Yeah, he was telling me this story. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. I was like, oh, no. All the stories about the dogs and the guns are real. That is real. So
the only Brauhaus stories I have, I used to live in Lincoln Square in 1995, 1996, and that, you know, it was a different area before the old town school came in there. And so my roommate, Mike, got a job bussing tables at the Brauhaus.
Nice.
So we were in. Like, I hung out in the Brauhaus.
All the Brauhaus beer you could drink.
22 years old, 21 years old, when the doors closed, hanging out with the waitresses, hanging out with Kiki. Like, it's a whole different game when you're hanging out with Kiki. Like, but on Saturday nights, everyone would be all dressed up in there, and the band would be playing, Gunther and Harry. Yeah. And I would, like I said earlier, many of $5 bills put in the fishbowl, being like, Lady in Red. And this is the look as lovely as you did today. So good. Anyway, let's get back to summer jobs. Talk summer jobs. This is a big story to me.
And it's a good news story.
It is a good news story. Mayor Emanuel comes out yesterday saying, you know what? I was talking about it at Malcolm X College, and it's something that I feel has a prospect for a positive impact on the city of Chicago, and that's a summer youth jobs program. We have taken that away in the past. We're bringing it back. Money from the city, money from the private sector, 30,000 jobs for Chicago youth this summer. That could see an impact on some of the trends.
It's very impressive, and it was at about 10,000 when the mayor first started in 2011, and he's more than doubled it. He's really boosted it quite a bit, and you know there's other people that are piling on. I mean, I think that there's a realization and understanding that kids in at-risk neighborhoods need to have something to do, and they need to have something to do that's positive and something that puts them on a good path. And it's not just the mayor. I mean, there's this other program, I think Arise Chicago, that's doing something. The Emerson Collective, which is the foundation started by Steve Jobs.
And this is the
wife.
McCormick Foundation's doing this one summer job program.
The Emerson Collective, run by Arnie Duncan here in Chicago, you know, they're doing a lot of not necessarily summer jobs, but finding
internships
like and programs for kids to do.
I just think that it's a story, I think, in Chicago news that a lot of times gets buried. We'll talk all about the negative aspects of the city and you know, when it bleeds, it leads. We've heard that a million times. But there's something about the mayor being pressured to come up with solutions for the epidemics that we face as a city. And this is a good start. This is a strong start. He went, you know, and I thought it was really telling that he made it very clear he did not get any money from the state. He didn't get any money from the feds. No federal money into this. No state. This is private sector and the city of Chicago stepping up to do that. I think that says something.
No, it's a great program. It's good that the mayor has really put his shoulder into this. I think it's an example of what can happen if the mayor decides that it's a priority and how he wants to turn things around. And, you know, I think that people in at-risk communities have said again and again and again, we want more of this sort of thing.
Okay, I'll ask the one challenging question to this. How do you get kids who are possibly in a gang, possibly hanging out on a street corner, on Chicago's west side, to get into this program? Yeah. I mean, because we had Lil Bibby and G Herbo in here last week, and one of the things that Lil Bibby said, he said, where we grew up in South Shore, there's a great after-school facility. Nobody uses it.
Yeah. And I think that that's a challenge. You know, I mean, one of the things that has actually been tripping up the Emanuel administration a little bit is that they have been going to groups like McCormick Foundation to run these programs, and they've been going to the bigger organizations to, you know, run these kind of programs. And a lot of the smaller programs that are run out of church basements and, you know, schools and stuff like that have really been suffering. They haven't been getting the same kind of attention that some of these bigger
marquee programs have. There's clout or hierarchy even in helping communities.
I don't even think that it's necessarily intentional. I mean, you know, one of the problems that you have when you have some of these smaller programs is that you don't have really as much administrative ability. And, you know, you get a group like McCormick Foundation that has maybe millions of dollars to spend. What they want are people who are going to be filling out sheets on metrics and how you're performing and, you know, how much you're being paid. And, well, there's a lot of paperwork that comes with it. And some of these things that are run out of church basements, they're just not set up to do that kind of stuff.
I do think, you know, Mayor Emanuel, this is an interesting time because he came out, he did that special speech at Malcolm X College. He talked about trying to get the private sector to step up.
Yep.
It's interesting because I don't know if Mayor Daley had the issue where there was no state funds or no Fed funds coming in. I mean, this is a peculiar time, an interesting and unique time to be a politician, a lawmaker who runs a big city like Chicago.
I think it's going to get even more challenging. I mean, we're looking at the state continuing to have its problems, and most of the money comes from the state, but also from the feds. You know, a lot of what President Trump's budget is going to be proposing is going to be a lot of cuts for programs that cities tend to depend on.
Like social service stuff?
Social services. I think, you know, we can expect cuts to social services. I think there's a lot of word that we can expect cuts to mass transit and transportation programs. A whole gamut. I mean, I think there's probably going to be cuts to community development block grants as well. I mean, there's a lot of that stuff is city stuff.
The long-standing conversations we've had in Chicago, in society, about whether or not the private sector should be responsible for public works or for, social service programs.
Right.
That used to be a philosophical question.
Right.
In which we would ask and debate over beers at a bar, wherever you do it. You're getting to the point where that is not even a question anymore. It just has to be, just based on the way that governments are forcing cities and other municipalities to work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's probably going to be more private sector stepping in at some point. I'm not exactly sure how it works. You know, I mean, once upon a time, the L in Chicago was run by the private sector, and the water was run by the city, but, you know, everything else was run by the private sector. And then it kind of slowly got taken over over time. I'm not sure that you can have a lot of these basic utilities and services be run by the private sector, because where do you make your money, right?
That's interesting. Joyce Coffey was in here just a couple weeks ago, and she's like, what if you, and we got a break, but what if you incentivize companies, meaning do they get some sort of investment opportunity or credit based on the fact that they helped fix the water pipes underneath their buildings? Or, you know, like, oh, that's an interesting concept.
That's done all the time, actually. I mean, when you're going to build a building, a lot of times the deal is, okay, you want to build the skyscraper, well, then you got to pay for all this other utility stuff around your building.
But in this case, she's talking about incentivizing in some way for them to have it be part of their business plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I don't know what the answer is, but it's one that we'll continue to talk about. Mike Fouché.
Great to be here.
The Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. Great to see you, bud.
Love it.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Big show tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Bethany Thomas is going to join us. Great musician and actor here in Chicago. Bethany's got a month-long residency at The Hideout, where she is transforming herself One night she did, the first week of March, she did Linda Ronstadt. I believe it was last week she did Lou Reed. And she has got a new EP out. She is a she's a perfect hybrid of actor, musician, and she's going to be in performing live tonight. So we'll talk with Bethany Thomas. Also tonight, the Chicago Children's Theater is putting on a famous children's book, The Year I Didn't Go to School. Giselle Potter wrote this book 15, 17 years ago. It's really based on a true story where her family took a year off to travel Europe as a puppet theater. They were street performers. And she wrote this book, and Giselle Potter is great. If you don't know her work, you can see it every week in the New York Times. She does illustrations. Anyway, her book is being adapted to stage. It's on stage right now at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts in Streeterville, River North here. And Heidi Stillman from the Looking Glass Theater did the play, and Giselle and Heidi will be in studio, and we'll talk about that process. So that's coming up later tonight on The Download. Well, we just talked about the mayor's summer job program and police reforms with Mike Fouché, and both of those items have everything to do with Chicago's issues surrounding gun violence. Communities affected by violence are fighting not only to take their neighborhoods back from gangs and other social ills, but they're fighting a media narrative that paints broad strokes across big sections of Chicago's south and west sides. It makes it tough for communities to talk about the positive things happening or even other news that may be important for the city or the neighborhood to know about. That's something that's a constant struggle for the Inglewood neighborhood, the neighborhood that's been at the center of Chicago's gun violence epidemic. Turning the tide and writing the narrative is one of the tasks of my next guest. He's a pastor of Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago in Inglewood, and he is Pastor K. Andre Brooks. He has been at the church for about 4 years, and he joins me tonight at the big table. Pastor Brooks, thanks for being here.
Man, thank you for having me.
It's an interesting, the conversation we were having just about, you know, positive narratives, that's something you have to deal with. I know that's something that you feel strongly about, the idea that Chicago far too often paints Inglewood in one certain way.
Well, as a preacher, my responsibility and job is to share the good news and the good news of the gospel. And the gospel manifests itself in the great people that exist in the city. And there are so many great things that are occurring, and so many great people and so many great communities that exist within Inglewood. But we know if you articulate a narrative that's inconsistent with the values of real people, you know, you get a great story.
Do you feel like, I guess a better question, a less loaded question is, do you feel that the narrative, let me put it this way, there's always been that narrative. Do you feel like it's gotten better? Do you feel it's gotten worse? Like, do you feel like the media in Chicago is doing an accurate job of portraying the communities that are affected by gun violence?
Well, absolutely not. Because if you want to be proactive and preventative, you will talk about the great things that are occurring in Inglewood. But, you know, that doesn't sell. You know, it's a culture that's based off sensationalism, and we want to continue a narrative of Inglewood equating Inglewood to gun violence, not the once great community that was anchored in a thriving European class migrants who came in and settled at the back of the yards, and a great number of African Americans who migrated from Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana to create one of the first black affluent communities in Inglewood. And their children, you know, came and continued to build up their great area, such to the extent that Ogden Park exists. And the first mayor of Chicago is in Inglewood, the notable Inglewood High School, you know, when it was primarily all white. It was the economic bastion of the whole city. It was outside the downtown, it was the second most economically thriving commercial district in the area. And so, you know, we can talk about that. But no, you want to talk about Chief Keefe. You want to talk about the gangs. You want to talk about those things because, you know, we would like to talk about those things as it relates to the image and history of Chicago.
But do you wonder? I mean, I wonder if the media wants to talk about those things because they are. I mean, you're talking about things like life and death. You're talking about death, and you're talking about a lot of terrible stories that come out where people are accidentally shot or caught in the crossfire, or kids are shot. I mean, there seems to be people want to come from the right place in wanting to cover that stuff because they feel like, hey, we don't want any of this to happen in a community that we live.
Well, it's part of the, you know, historic narrative of really, you know, being condescending to a people who have been disinherited and disenfranchised. This is Chicago. And Chicago is known for Al Capone and the gangs. And, of course, we romanticize that in American culture. We don't romanticize when it comes to the gangster disciples or the black disciples or the Bloods and the Crips. The real issue there is disinvestment, you know, economic disenfranchisement, economic violence. But, you know, it's a good story. You know, it's a good boys in the hood story. It's a good juice story. And that's what, you know, our appetite in our culture is anxious for. And we have to let them know, you know, they are seniors and elders who have continue to live in Inglewood, who settled there some 40, 50, 60 years ago and has still remained the backdrop of the community. And we want the value of their properties to continue to appreciate. They want to walk down the street and, you know, play with their children. And those things still exist. But, of course, you know, we need a narrative, because where there's a narrative of economic decadence, there's also opportunity for many to come in and profit by.
You think? I mean, I guess when I think about that, and I think about that, that's concept. I mean, you're right. I mean, we romanticize Al Capone. We don't romanticize black gangs. I mean, there's something about that. And African American, the same concept of illicit material or illicit behavior is considered, you know, that's terrible. But what we saw with sort of the Italian gangs and things is people are people, sir, are attached to that.
Right. As a preacher, we have this theme, lest we forget. And, of course, in our Hebraic brothers and Jewish cultures, lest we forget that, you know, this beautiful area downtown was settled by people who were part of gangs. And the biggest gangs were the industrialists who came from Boston and New York and even Philadelphia to say, we want to build off of this city on Chicago River, and we're going to do what we can ruthlessly to take over, with no respect for those people who had already settled, mm-hmm. like Odusava and some Frenchmen who were really working and developing on the Chicago River. Push them out of the way, and we're going to build these big, great skyscrapers all in the name of, you know, capitalism and tyranny. Of course, we don't talk about that, but that's how this great city came to be. But so when we start talking about the narrative of gangs, which for disenfranchised community is a rite of passage into industry. Now, that industry in many cases may be the black market. Interesting we use the term black market, and not the white market or white collar. It's only what they have an opportunity to be.
I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, in the way that you can, there is something to that. We'll continue the conversation. Pastor K. Andre Brooks is my guest tonight. He's the pastor of Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago in Inglewood. We're talking about the Inglewood neighborhood, the narrative that comes out through the media about Inglewood. And we come back, let's talk more about the church's role. What are you doing specifically to turn the tide, to sort of counter the narratives that come out of the mainstream media? Pastor Brooks in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest at the big table tonight, Pastor K. Andre Brooks. He's the pastor of Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago in Inglewood, talking about the narrative surrounding communities like Inglewood when it comes to violence, gun violence, gang violence, and what we sort of see on the 10 o'clock news, if you will. You know, it is for you in the church to have to preach on Sundays or any other day. What are you saying to the congregation when there is this epidemic around you, around the neighborhood? Because as much as the narrative it can be broad, it's not wrong in the way that, yes, there is gang violence on street corners in Inglewood. What are you saying to the congregation that comes to your church about the neighborhood, about what's happening?
To remind them to turn off these, you know, the news media and listen to what it is essentially that we believe in as a value system, that we are to shape a beloved community where all people can come together and live in harmony and live anchored in love, and that we have a responsibility to engage everyone and address issues of social injustice, economic injustice that is a part of our community. And so we have to be a church that has a significant impact in the community. That we don't exist in the walls, but we exist to shape mm-hmm. culture. We exist to shape policy. We exist to be prophetic in our role to leverage power with the corporations and the government to say that we are the advocates for the community. Anytime you don't have anyone advocating for the community, corporations, of course, industrialists, and the government can do what they want to do. And that's been historically what
is that happened. Is that the role, you think, of a preacher, of a pastor, the idea that you represent neighborhoods and communities even beyond the congregation, the people who worship in your church?
Well, when I read the Bible and the Old Testament and New Testament, the prophets were always about, you know, leveraging on behalf of not just their own particular group, but for the group of people who where tyranny existed. And so being a child and being part of the byproduct of the civil rights movement and the history of the African Methodist Episcopal Church of 1787, which was always anchored on abolition and freedom and really adhering to this constitution that said all men are created equal. See, we challenged those policies. We challenged law in order to make room at the table where the government said you were 3/5 of a person. You don't have the right to exist. And Jim Crow, you know, all of those things that we talk about as mm-hmm. part of not just black history, but American history. And if it wasn't for the tension applied by, you know, pastors, imams, rabbis who are part of the civil rights movement with William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass, who are part of the, you know, Freedmen's Bureau. So not so many, you know, coalitions of individuals led by black preachers. And let us not forget that, to say, no, we're going to make America great because we too are Americans. And so sometimes you people forget that, you know, these are Americans that exist in Inglewood. We like to talk about Chicago, but, you know, we are Americans. And so when you have so much investment downtown and, you know, on Michigan Avenue, you have to, you know, develop uptown if you really want to have shared prosperity.
How do you do that? I mean, as a pastor, as a leader in your community, how do you? It's one thing to preach to your congregation about the injustices, the social injustices and economic injustices. But how do you get the attention of investors, of police or other places that may be able to help with those causes that you're talking about from, you know, in the church?
Well, first and foremost, the Bible declares where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. But when you have a system that tells a people that they're nothing, they don't see the economic value of who they are, and they don't see the economic value of their communities. And when you see a system that is, look at our educational system, that is not equally funded and or separate educational system with not the same quality of materials, the people think that they don't matter. And when people don't think that they matter, they become disinherited, they become disenfranchised, and oftentimes results in the black market or, in many cases, level of immorality and or irresponsibility or victimization, where they say we got to do because no one cares about us. And what happens is we turn on each other. And when we turn on each other, we really strategically kill out any ability to advocate for our own interests. And that has historically been the narrative in our communities, where even since slavery, you can divide a community based off of a number of different things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the black pastor and the preachers has always had a historical significant role in that process of organizing people, to telling them, articulating a narrative of why certain things occur. To remind folk that there is a such thing as social engineering that says that we can divide and separate a city of Chicago based off of the Dan Ryan.
Well, I mean, I was, you know, checking out your site and everything about it, and you have pictures with young gentlemen who are, you know, part of the church or, you know, outreach in some form. How do you reach out to people who may be going through the things that you just mentioned? The idea of disenfranchisement or disinheritance, like the idea that they're already past the point where you can preach to them and say, come on back.
Well, it's one thing to address issues of immorality and morality, but they don't think that they have that America is even theirs, that they don't have a place at the table. And that's the first problem that we have, that I focus on debunking and dispelling. That no, we too are Americans, and you are a citizen, and you know you invest in the city, and you should expect returns on that investment. And so, when you have people who have not culturally been politically reinforced in terms of their identity, they don't see this as part of
right.
the system.
And so how do you get them back? How do you do it?
By telling them that we too are Americans, by saying we too are Chicagoans.
So essentially just try to preach to them one-to-one.
Preach to them one-on-one. Everything's about relationship. It's about registering to vote. It's about mobilizing. It's about going, you know, leaving Inglewood and coming down to see what DuSable built on the Chicago River that's yours. So sometimes you don't think you're supposed to, you know, I'm supposed to go to the beach. You know, the north side only belongs to the white folk. You know, this part of Ashland only belongs to, you know, historically white folks. And so it's a lot of things that ideally our educational system should be doing to foster the sense of socialization that says that to these citizens that, you know, Inglewood is theirs, Chicago is theirs, America is theirs, the world is theirs. But we, you know, our educational system has not done that. And we have to really start to revisit how we look at education, not just for Inglewoodians, but for folk in Lincoln Park, you know, our white brothers, our, you know, Latino brothers and sisters, so our Asian brothers and sisters, so that they can see the value of this, the beauty of what we call multiculturalism. But people don't see it because we oftentimes don't equate being black with excellence. And so you can give them subpar policies and subpar resources, and the city agencies does not have to work.
Well, let's talk about the city agencies and the programs. I mean, Mike and I in the 7:30 talked about this in the last hour, just about the summer jobs program, police reform. A lot to talk about. Pastor K. Andre Brooks in studio. He's the pastor of Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago and Inglewood. It's a mouthful.
That's right.
Pastor Brooks in studio tonight. Well, let's take a break, get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back and more with Pastor Brooks. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Pastor K. Andre Brooks. He's the pastor of Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago in Inglewood. Talking about the Inglewood neighborhood, we're talking about narratives and stereotypes and really what needs to be done to break the patterns of people in impoverished neighborhoods who have become disenfranchised. And that's sort of my takeaway from the first half of our conversation. Just this idea that, you know, because of threads and narratives and this idea of people feeling like this is not their city or this is not their country, they're not listened to, they're not heard, they're not seen, that they feel like they're not worth anything, and they move on to immoral behavior. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, not move on, they kind of force. And it's a matter of survival, which, you know, explains why there is so-called gang rite of passage is so, you know, pervasive in so-called black communities, is mm-hmm. because if you grow up in a particular block and everyone is a participant in a gang, that's what you do. And so if I grow up in a house where everybody on the block is an attorney or a doctor, that's what we do. And so people oftentimes forget those things, and these communities become disinvested or disenfranchised because there are no jobs, and the jobs leave. And when the jobs go away and opportunities go away, what are people supposed to do? They've all had an inferior educational system where, you know, you didn't get resources. You know, when you segregate communities intentionally, when you socially engineer certain things, you know, there's a byproduct. And oftentimes people do not want to talk about it because it's easy to blame those folks for their action. But we all are Americans. We all are Chicagoans. We all are Illinoisans. And we should be able to say, you know, we all want to share prosperity. But there should be some level of sensitivity.
Yeah, there's so much I want to talk to you about. Education as well. Let's stick with jobs. The mayor put out his summer jobs program for youth, the youth jobs movement, 30,000 jobs. He had kind of talked about this at Malcolm X College, this way of using community and using resources that the city has, including private sector resources, to tackle issues like violence and poverty. Jobs are one of the ways to do it. We hear it all the time. You just mentioned it as well. This is a youth job program. What's your first thought on the mayor's announcement this week and what it means for neighborhoods like Inglewood?
First of all, I commend the mayor for, you know, just getting the investment. And the investment into our youth. Again, you know, we have a number of different unfunded mandates. You can really determine what a person prioritizes based off what they're interested in spending their money on. And so for me, it says that he cares and is concerned about, you know, these young people. And so the jobs are great. However, the question is who administers these opportunities and these jobs. So oftentimes when resources are allocated, they're allocated to a paragovernmental organization or they're allocated to the universities who create their own systems that are based off of deficiency models, when instead they should, I would recommend going down, looking from a bottom-up perspective.
You're saying that a lot of times, and it's the case here too, I mean, McCormick Foundation is the one who's administering this project, but the concept being that there are not-for-profits and churches and other places that are entrenched in these communities, know the kids by their first name, that are getting shut out of this. They're not getting the funds or the resources to invest in their communities. It's being done from afar, from somewhere, from City Hall.
And that's the problem. There are ways that there can be accountability measures to, as well as staff development measures to strengthen social enterprises, let me say that, in the community that are grassroots. Greater St. John is the first African-American church built in Inglewood. And it had, you know, not just black folk, but white folk attended. And it's always historically been that way. And so we know what we're doing. We've been part of that process. And there are great organizations that exist in Inglewood who've been about the work. And so, you know, the coffers are not as large, but you have a coordinated effort of volunteers who want to do the work. And so when all of the resources go to the paragovernmental organization of various agencies, then, you know, oftentimes, you know, you know, people call preachers poverty pimps. But no, this vulture comes in so many other guises that people start to benefit economically off the despair. So we need to find ways where those jobs and opportunities can really build capacity on a real basic local level. I don't know. I don't have the answers, but we need to really start having a real dialogue. And oftentimes, you know, the block club leaders and presidents, the old man on who the World War II veteran who lives in the community, who bought his home, you know, just come out and talk and engage us and respect us. Then you'll be able to get a perspective because they know the young people.
All right, let me works. Let me ask you this. I'm sorry to interrupt. Okay, so we talked about this in the last hour, but I saw some guests that were on last week talked about it as well. You know, they were the two guys who grew up in South Shore, and they said the after school programs and the after school buildings are there. Nobody goes. The same question I would ask about, there are 30,000 jobs. How do you get the kid who's on the corner to go apply online at the McCormick Foundation for a job? I mean, how do you do it in the sense that you have, as you mentioned the first half, this idea of a disenfranchised youth? How do you get them to go from what we're seeing, which is a great, good, positive story online, to actually having it work in real life?
Well, these same young people see their parents unemployed and even undereducated and, you know, lives falling apart. And, you know, the question is, I see it, but does it really work? You know, is there any future in it? Now, put those resources in pre-K and first grades and second grades, and so engage them early. You can put anything great in a community. Everybody wants, but do they really see the value of it? And the value of a thing is really based off the value of a person. So, you know, one thing about resilient black people is that they can see a hustle. And if they sense that it's not sincere, they're not going to engage in it. So there are a lot of great after-school programs, but what are you teaching in the after-school program? Our children in Inglewood grow up around transportation. Billions of dollars go through Inglewood. It seems that they maybe in the first, second, third grade, you should be teaching them how to be part of, you know, Norfolk Southern and how to get jobs and opportunities.
Trains coming through there. Yeah.
Trains coming through.
Yeah,
there. So in Ogden Park and other recreation centers, maybe you should have train tracks that builds capacity for them to stay in their community and help develop their community. After school program, what is in there? You know, you can have items, but do you have anyone to facilitate introduction to lacrosse or rugby or golf and learning Mandarin and learning different things, you know? So, you know, after school programs exist, but they're also going to go to young people. Young people are going to go, what's hip and what's, right, you know, what's cool. And so sometimes people can say, well, they don't participate, but I can guarantee, and there are people in the community that can guarantee an increased number of participation if there is indeed quality, real interest.
Quickly on education, I'm interested because CPS and the mayor have almost determined that the idea of resourcing a neighborhood school in a poverty-stricken neighborhood is less of a go-to than creating a system like selective enrollment where someone from Inglewood can go to a different school. You know what? We can go up on the north side and go somewhere. I mean, you saw that in the last time. It was the Arne Duncan movement and this idea that there was this recognition by the politicians and the lawmakers here in Chicago that said, you know what, instead of we've tried to throw money, and maybe that's not true, but they've tried to throw money at different schools. It hasn't worked in certain communities. So let's give those people an opportunity to go into different schools. It feels like that's well intended. Was that a bad idea by the city of Chicago?
What made it a bad idea is that you don't really recognize the real human capital, and just throwing money is not the solution, and it fosters a lot of frustration because the answer is not money. It's how we use our resources, respect and value the human assets, and let's build around them. And you would do that if in the room you have individuals who can share different perspectives. But So when it comes to policy, and policy becomes concrete based off the interests of who's in power. And so everyone wants to think for black folk, but oftentimes black folk are not in the room. And just because you attend the University of Chicago or Harvard, and I love those two great schools, don't mean that they have the answer. Maybe engaging someone from Wilberforce University or Chicago State University or one of the former gang leaders or one of the grandmas, because they are human assets and human capital that can also give a real perspective of my son wanted to be a truck driver because he see all of these trucks, or my daughter is interested in being an engineer because she see this train in our backyard, and find ways to develop the local economy. The children go to the beach, you know, how do I become a part of the maritime industries? You know, how do I become, you see Midway Airport, how can I become a pilot? How can I? So, you know,
and
we don't do that.
Those
opportunities,
there.
Because, you know, we say go become a doctor, a lawyer. You know, those are great and lofty. However, we need to make education practical and meaningful so that young people first and foremost see their parents employed, engaged. Again, Inglewood is anchored off of the back of the yards and the transportation logistics of being a city that webbed out all across not just America, but all entire North America. That's what made it a great community. So now, you know, we can, if we build this new high school, it suggests that this investment in these new programs and the investment in a new high school, it may be the mayor is really seeing this as a global city, and because it now we need to anchor jobs, mm-hmm. anchor opportunities. That's really going to spark our economy, because the south side of Chicago is a great place to live, and it's a great place to build.
A lot of, you know, it's interesting because there's a flurry of texts that come in to the radio station. And, you know, just reading them in the last break, just questions they want me to ask you about family situation of your congregation. Some comments about pull up of the bootstraps. You know, if these kids, you know, do what I did, no excuses, stop talking about the past, talk about the future. You get, there's some stuff in there about just, you know, I could get a job in 2 days. Why can't people find a job? What do you think about all this stuff? Because it kind of plays into the narrative as we're talking about. I mean, just in general, the way people, as you just mentioned, sort of see the black community or see certain communities in Chicago.
It really saddens me, and I wouldn't want to, you know, create a stereotype about who's saying those things, because it speaks to our illiteracy and our, you know, a historic perspective about, you know, who and how we became people. And what oftentimes happened with young folk, particularly African Americans, they rebel and they become rages about the lack of sensitivity. And so I would welcome anyone all around this region to come to Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church and see families, strong families, and see, you know, men and women. The basic form of our socialization is based off man, woman, and child. And every man and woman wants to have their own job, wants to have their own home. And for people to buy into this narrative that everybody is a welfare mom, that stuff is continually perpetuated by the media. All they got to do is come to the local churches or invite me out to that church, and I'll bring strong families who've been married for 40, 50 years, young men who are proudly, and young women who may have had a baby out of wedlock and 15, 16 years old, still strong. So it exists. But as long as our fellow Americans or fellow Chicagoans have that attitude, they need a check, you know, checkup. And so much of the Black Lives Matter movement was a direct result of this white supremacist condescending attitude that conservatives and liberals have about, you know, what black people can do and should be able to do.
Where does that, I mean, but you as a pastor, and I think about, you know, I even think about the sort of leadership of the African-American community in Chicago. It's been stronger. You know, I mean, in the way that I think of mayors and aldermen and congressmen and preachers really stepping forward and having a voice, it's less than it has been in the past. Why do you think that is? And what, when you talk about the black community having the need to represent itself, how can you change it? How can you make sure that that happens?
Well, first and foremost, you know, historically, you know, you know, the black community, or if you wanted to talk with someone in the community, you didn't have to call and find Dr. Cornel West or Michael Larry Dyson, because there was people who were part of the community, and you didn't have to just go to the pastor. You can go to a very educated and an intelligent group of people in the local churches. However, historically, what we see is there's this movie going on tonight, and it's supposed to talk about the mega church and this mega pastor, black pastor, and the dysfunction. It's like a soap opera. And you see many caricatures about the black preacher and the black pastor that really, you know, destroys the executive leadership of a community. You never hear an, you know, a
this
rabbi.
Is the poverty pimp.
The poverty pimp. Yeah, but you never, you know, you don't hear the critique of rabbis. You don't hear the critique of.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is it because of bad apples?
No, it's not bad apples. Because it's strategic. It's socially engineered. You know, it's a reason why, you know, Muslims respond in the way that they do when you attack a particular leader. And so immoral and irresponsibility transgressions are transgressions. You know, people do bad things. But when you target particularly black folks and you make these caricatures out of black preachers, but the Flip Wilson show, you know, you start to create a desensitivity towards the most powerful institution that has been about the upliftment of a community, and that has been the black church and the black pastor. And so as our culture becomes, you know, more secularized, we see a mass engagement of people saying, I ain't dealing with the black church because the preacher's going to take the money. No, we're organizing community. We're building schools. When there was no integration, you know, black people built their own schools, which is the impetus for a number of our colleges, like Wilberforce University or Paul Quinn College or Cheney College or Lincoln College, because they didn't have access to the white universities. And so, you know, those why those things exist. But people need to wake up and see, black history is a form of American history. It's something that you got to be sensitive to embrace and embrace all of us as, you know, citizens of this country. If not, you know, we're going to profit or pay for whatever our children become. And there, yes, you know, children are rebelling because of white supremacy. And people don't want to talk about white supremacy or white privilege. It's real. Racism is real. And the election of our President Trump has really shown that, because we see a group of people rallying behind an ideology. So we got some problems that we got to fix.
Pastor K. Andre Brooks, can't thank you enough for coming in. He's the pastor of Greater St. John African Methodist Episcopal Church of Chicago in Englewood, talking about Englewood and the narrative around the neighbor, the historic Chicago neighborhood, and issues in the African American community. Pastor Brooks, great to meet you. Thanks,
man,
for coming
I'm
in.
Honored. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flam's in. We're going to do the swap meet. Of course, at DuPage Picker, we evaluate all your classic Chicago junk. The last week we had World War I and World War II stuff. And I hope the guy calls in tonight with the – he had casino chips from an illegal – Al Capone casino. Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? And then he sent a message to the Facebook page, and he was like, hey, I got a great story. And I'm like, yeah, call up and tell me about it. So hopefully he calls tonight, because I always love when the segment goes well is when you get that kind of, like, I have one of Mayor Daley's Indiana Jones hats. I'd be like, oh, that's great. Where'd you get that? That's awesome. Most people call up with signed baseball cards.
Fair
enough. You know, that's a thing. So, singer, songwriter, and actor Bethany Thomas is in the middle of a month-long residency at the Hideout. She plays every Monday night through March at the club at 1354 West Wabansia. This month's residency has Bethany playing tribute to Lou Reed and Linda Ronstadt. And coming up on the 27th, a release party for the new EP titled First. Bethany is in studio with her partner and producer, John Szymanski, and he brought his guitar. Bethany, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Last time we had you were in here with John Langford. Yeah. It's always a pleasure to have you and your talent in studio. John, good to see you
good
as well.
See you.
All right, let's hear some music. We want to get right to it. Here's a track. This is a new track, right?
Yeah.
And this is called He Don't Wanna.
Uh-huh.
All right, take it away.
Brother's been around the block. Brother says it's worked too damn hard. You still be punching a clock. He's worried that'll never turn things around, and he never lays his burden down. Brother mostly keeps to himself. and no one understands him, so he keeps his dreams up on the shelf. I know he's got so much love inside, but still he can't answer why. Why so afraid to try? He don't want to get high. He don't want to look up and touch the sky. How can I get you high? I want to get you high. Brother's always feeling down. He got pains in his head and pains in his heart, and he just spreads that pain around. The only time he ever cracks a smile, yeah, is when his baby comes around a while. And I wouldn't want to be in his shoes, even though everybody loves it when a big black girl sings blues. Times is hotter than they've been before, yeah. But all your good days ain't passed you by. And brother's not ashamed to cry, no. But he don't wanna get high. He don't wanna push off and learn to fly. How can I get you high?
Get on Michigan Avenue.
Awesome.
Pounding on the window. There you go. Bethany Thomas, John Szymanski in studio playing acoustic tonight. The new EP titled First. That was the track He Don't Wanna. All right, what we'll do, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk to you guys about the residency at the Hideout.
Yeah.
Bethany Thomas in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Bethany Thomas, John Szymanski in studio. Bethany's got the month-long residency at the Hideout. Monday nights, Robbie Folk's spot, as we know it, right?
Yeah.
Bethany, good to see you. Thanks for the performance, and good
sure.
to see you. So talk about the residency. I mean, this is something that you did close to this last year. You did three shows. What is it about doing a residency where you do a show a week that appeals to you?
I liked the idea of curating something, and I wanted to do something where just everything was very, like, disparate. Like, all the shows are way different in feel, in sound, in look, in my temperament, in my voice and the voices of others. And I don't know. So, yeah, I think we knew we wanted to do a release show and actually... And we were worried that we would never actually finish the EP if we didn't have a deadline.
of course. Yeah. As any good artist,
those
right,
things
will tell you.
So we knew we wanted to do that. And then we're like, okay, so the other weeks, let's do a couple crazy tribute shows. And then we've also got a show coming up this coming Monday, which is just us with a bunch of our friends just kind of doing some weirdo.
Is it stuff. Is it harder? I mean, because you do a lot of theater as well, and yeah. and you're accustomed to the idea of runs where you will have like a show a week or a show every weekend. Mm-hmm. But is it obviously it's harder in the fact that each one of these shows is entirely different. I mean, is that what's it, the challenge associated with that? Because I would assume that is an extra pressure that you may not be used to.
Yeah, the challenge is wrangling the artists. That's what it's been. That's been the main challenge for this. It's getting everybody in a room together to just maybe run through something, but mainly I'm just like, here's the vision. Here's what we're going for.
Right.
And if you can just pick up, you know, like the musical notes, that's great. But here's what I see. And sometimes, usually people are able to come along with me on that. And sometimes it's just kind of like, oh, okay, Bethany.
John, from your standpoint as a producing partner and someone who plays music with Bethany, when you talk about picking up somebody's vision or this curatorial concept of mm-hmm. 1 week doing one show, next week all into Ronstadt, next week something else. Talk about how you work in that kind of environment.
So I think it's a great thing because that's kind of how my brain works a lot is like, we have this opportunity to make something that's really cool that people aren't going to expect. And so when we were talking about, you know, having the whole month of shows, it was kind of like, well, what can we do that's really interesting? And like, I like the idea of having a different artist, but then also complementing that with a different group of players every week. So we've had... we're bringing in people that we've never played with before to kind of be with us on, you know, live. And then it's past two shows have been really fantastic because they've been – it's a different energy every time.
Well, let's talk about it. Yeah. I mean, you had the – I mean, this is sort of the height of the curatorial type of show.
Yeah.
Let's start with the Linda Ronstadt show that was at the beginning of the month. When you say Bethany Thomas does Linda Ronstadt or plays Linda Ronstadt, mm-hmm. you know, with your theater background, I mean, you could play – Linda Ronstadt, but my point being, how much of the actor comes out in you when you're covering or doing a tribute show for an artist?
It comes out a little bit. I think maybe not as much came out with this Linda show or this Lou show as it did for last year's Bowie show. That one, I think I was actually trying to be David Bowie, and these ones, I was like, okay, Yeah, I know that seems like a stretch too, but
well, no, I mean,
I was like trying to sound like him and stuff, and it's futile. But that was my vision, and it did all right. The Linda show, she's such a cool vocalist, and she does everything. She sings everything. She sings every genre, and she's done stuff that you didn't even hear about. And then you listen to it, you're like, oh my gosh, she rocks. And so I got into that. And of course, I watched a lot of live performances of her. And I'm not trying to act like her, be like her, look like her, or even really sound like her. But I like to find their essence.
Right.
I know that my onstage persona was different during the Linda show than it was during the Lou show. Yeah.
So you're trying you sort of channel the presence, not necessarily the, you know, sort of straight impression of the character.
Right. Yeah. Right. And the Linda stuff, I was trying to do her kind of. Her vocal takes on stuff because she was, and I hate saying cover artist, but like she was, like she didn't record her own stuff. So if you're not trying to kind of sound like Linda or do her arrangements exactly, then it's just like you're covering this Everly Brothers song, you know?
Right.
And that's not what it is. I was like, this is Linda. Check out Linda.
You know? I was turned on to Linda Ronstadt. I forgot it was a documentary or something where it was a special where I watched a ton of her material on all those sort of 70s Nashville variety shows.
Sure.
Oh, you know, like where she was like, always like with the weird
specials.
Spot. Yeah, Midnight Special and stuff like that. Where I was like, wow, I had no idea you're right, the range that she had and all the different things that she played. Lou Reed's another one that you took on last week. How did that go?
Yeah, that was just 2 days ago. That was pretty hot, I think. It was way, way different. It was just a full-on rock show. And when we were advertising it, I was kind of saying, I think I want it to be like a mix between like Hedwig and an Ike and Tina review. And I think we pulled that off.
Yeah, pretty much.
I saw Hedwig at the Oriental Theater last week, and I knew I wanted to go see it because I wanted it for
you
the
want to channel
show.
It, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I knew I needed some of that energy, and it totally paid off. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, but I was going to say, this week coming up is just you and friends, and that's a I don't want to say just, but that's a different, and then you have the EP show. Do you, I mean, from the experiments of doing these kind of tribute shows in residency, is it piquing your interest to do others? I mean, are other artists where you're like, you know what, I'm going to get up on stage?
Of course. We're always kind of like, we should do this. Yeah. We should do this. We could do a whole night of this. We could do a whole night of this. We could do a whole night of just sitting around and you just playing whatever comes in your head. And that's...
Well, that's sort of what next week is a little
bit.
But, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say, especially since we've started doing these sorts of things, everybody's coming out of the woodwork with something that we should do.
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Which is like, great, let's do it.
Bethany Thomas and John Szymanski in studio. Bethany has got the residency at the Hideout. The next show is this Monday coming up, and then the 27th will be the release party for the EP, the new EP that's just coming out. Yeah. Bethany's got one more song. You guys got one more song. What do you want to play?
We're going to do a song called Where I Want to Live.
Where I Want to Live. This is on the EP?
It is.
All right, here we go. Bethany Thomas, John Szymanski. Take it away.
Around your heart, that is where I want to live. If you feel weak, if you get cold, I'll keep you warm like a jacket. Around your heart, around your heart. Under your skin, wear me like a suit of armor. If you get hurt, I will bleed. I promise you won't feel a thing. Under your skin, under your skin. I wanna be so good to you. Let me be so good to you. Lord, get me on my knees, begging for the chance to be what you need. Da 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 da. Inside your bones, that's probably where you need me most. I'll be your rock, your very foundation. Make sure you're always standing tall. Inside your bones, inside your bones. 'Cause I wanna be so good to you. Let me be so good. Be what you need. around your heart. That is where I want to live.
Yeah, there we go. Bethany Thomas and John Szymanski. Bethany, one of the best voices in Chicago. I love having you on the. Thank you so much for coming on. The residency at the Hideout is every Monday this month. So two more. You got one on this upcoming Monday.
20th, 27th.
And the 27th is the EP release party. Mm-hmm. And you can check out. You're gonna be at Porchlight doing a musical coming up as well.
Yeah, two person Sondheim review.
There you go.
Match.
lot going on. Bethany Thomas, John Szymanski. Thanks for coming and thanks for playing.
Yeah, thank you.
Phew, man. Bethany Thomas, she can sing. Wow. I mean, it's like one of the best singers in Chicago, one of the best voices. I feel like I could say that, you know? Like, I feel like, Pete, you and I, we have a lot of different musicians that come through here, and there's great musicians all the time, and we send some of the best. And this is the second time we've had Bethany in, and both times I'm like, wow. So, wow, very powerful. Good work. She's at the Hideout Monday nights through the month of March. Awesome to have her here. All right, coming up, Giselle Potter and Heidi Stillman are going to be in studio. We're going to talk about the adaptation that's on stage at the Chicago Children's Theater, The Year I Didn't Go to School. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new production is on stage at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts. It's a show produced by the Chicago Children's Theater in partnership with the Actors Gymnasium. It's called The Year I Didn't Go to School, a homemade circus. The play is adapted and directed by Looking Glass Artistic Director Heidi Stillman. Stillman, creative force, producing, directing, acting, and writing several plays for Looking Glass as well as other places around the city and around the country. And this production, The Year I Didn't Go to School, a homemade circus, is another hit for Stillman as the show is getting rave reviews. If that title sounds familiar, it's because the play is adapted from the famous children's book by renowned New York author Giselle Potter. Potter, who's always been known as one of the best illustrators in the field, has penned her own books as well, including this one, which is based on the true story of traveling around Europe with her family. Potter's latest book is also getting great reviews. This is My Dollhouse. And you can see Potter's illustrations on display as part of the Well section of the New York Times. She illustrates the Ties column. Giselle Potter's in town this week to see her book come to life on stage. And it's my pleasure to welcome Giselle and Heidi Stillman to the show tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this. I'll start with you, Heidi. I mean, talk about what drew you to this project. What was it about this that you wanted to adapt to put on the stage?
Well, a friend of mine gave me this book when I had my children, and it was our favorite book. I read it to them over and over and over again, and they just loved it. And I was really intrigued with all of the little performance tidbits that are throughout the book, because it's based on her family street performing in Italy. And they were so clever and so charming and beautiful. I always wanted to see them embodied and see them for real, you know, alive, right, embodied. So that was kind of the impetus. And so I went to Jackie, who's the artistic director at Chicago Children's Theater, and said, you know, I would really love to do this. And she liked the idea, so.
One of the great things in Looking Glass and the Actors Gymnasium, you guys have done this for years, is you've been able to take theatrics, you know, beyond just the stage. You put in the air. There's a lot of gymnastics or acrobats that go along with production. Talk about that role of creating a circus and being able to do interesting things with the staging because of this text.
Yeah, well, that's an interest that I've always had, you know, coming out of school, and Looking Glass has always been really interested in that, in physical theater and visual theater. I think we're also very visual, and we feel like the visual holds content, not just words. And so it just seemed like a great match to have the Actors Gymnasium also working on it. And my friend Sylvia Hernandez de Stasi is the choreographer. And so we added, you know, a little bit of circus stuff to the performances as well.
Let's bring in Giselle. I'm so happy to have you here. Your illustrations are tremendous. I mean, they're just, think about all the books that you've been involved in that you've illustrated, but you've also penned. Talk about this story and why you chose to write this story as opposed to the before this. I mean, you were just pretty much doing illustrations. Talk about this story.
Yeah, I started just doing illustrating other people's stories, and then I wrote this book, The Year I Didn't Go to School, and another book also called Chloe's Birthday and Me, both about my childhood. But it took a little while of just illustrating other people's stories before I felt like I could write my own. And it kind of was encouraged by my editor a little bit, just to, you know, she read my biography and said, well, why don't you write a story about that? And, you know, that was 15 years ago from now. So, you know, it's, everything's, I keep forgetting things. But one way that I could remember things was I had a journal, and the end papers of the book are my journal from when I was eight. Yeah. So I could look at that to remember things combined with photographs and asking my parents. But a lot of it is, you know, very vague memories from when I was eight. And so those two books were about my childhood. And then more recently, I wrote books again after, you know, 30 books or something of other people's. I didn't think of it. And then all of a sudden now that I had kids and felt inspired again to write things. You know, both the new books that I have are inspired by my kids.
And I want to get to the story. You know, it's fascinating, too, because I was reading some interviews about the idea of the creative approach to illustrating other people's stories and what that does for you. I mean, the idea that it's not necessarily your story, but you really do dig into being able to draw somebody else's.
Right, and find something that I connect to. I mean, usually, you know, just making up characters, you have to decide who they are and have some reason, you know, connect to who they are. And so if it was a story that I had no connection at all, it would be really hard for me to illustrate it. So it's usually stories that I can find something of myself or, you know, something that I know. And that's what's really great about the New York Times, what you were mentioning, too, because it's these really personal stories every week. And
very emotional,
always, lot of times I can find something that I know, too, from those stories. And that's definitely easier for me, the kind of narrative aspect of it, than editorial can often be more conceptual. And I never know what to do with that.
Well, let's get back to the year I didn't go to school. That story, as Heidi talked about, is a story that we all know, because if anyone has kids, you've read that story. It does feel a little fictional in the way that it's like, you know, it's a year without school. I took off school to be a street performer. But this is a true story.
It is true. Yeah. I mean, my parents started the puppet theater when I was about two, and at first it was this giant crazy thing with all their friends, and then it kind of pared down to just be our family so that they could travel. And the book, The Year I Didn't Go to School, is kind of compiling all different times. It wasn't actually, all of that wasn't just in one year, and we didn't just go to Italy for one year, right. And I missed often more school. There was one year that I completely missed, which actually was when I was eight, but then other times I'd miss a month here or there. We'd, you know, do smaller trips. And but, you know, it's just for a children's book's sake, it was compiling all the most exciting things of, you know, probably years of different memories.
Well, Chris Jones in the Tribune, when given this a great review, I mean, he seemed to really enjoy it. But he talked about it being one of the best arguments for an arts education, because the concept being that by living it, and instead of being in school, and actually that the lessons that are taught from being in the arts are more, sometimes more worthwhile than what you read in the book. Was that the concept? Was that what you were going for in this sort of mission and the lesson of the book?
It's funny. I didn't even think of it as being a lesson or thinking. I have heard people ask me, oh, you know, are you into homeschooling? And I actually never, you know, I haven't done that myself for my own kids. And I don't think my parents really consciously thought, we're doing homeschooling and we're taking you out of school and this is education for you. I mean, it was just, they didn't really... I mean, I'm kind of surprised we didn't really keep up with schoolwork at all that year. I mean, you know, a few little things here and there. But, you know, now I feel like you'd have to be more on top of what you're missing in third grade or whatever, you know.
Right.
But it wasn't, you know, some decision that, you know, this is a better education for you. It worked out that way, but I don't think anybody thought about it, really.
I loved that. That aspect of the book, you know, and that just that the parents are kind of living their lives in a different way than a lot of people are, and just kind of, you know, the beauty of that and all the adventures that you guys had. And I really like that. And in the play, I tried to throw some of that stuff into, like, what do I think I know about art? What have I learned from art or from living a life, you know? Because I also found, as a person in the arts with kids who, you know, we're all making shows all the time and in shows all the time, I definitely related to your book and those in those ways.
And it's funny because they did that, and they were much younger than I am when I had kids, and I think they're just much more wild and free about just doing things like that, but I just didn't do any of that. It's so funny. I mean, I obviously we do lots of art and all kinds of things with our kids, but I just never thought, oh, I'll just take them out of school whenever I want. What if we run out of money while we're traveling? We'll just figure it out. Yeah. All that kind of stuff. I'm much more practical.
I think we get a little skittish on a 3-day weekend.
Exactly. You know, like, I feel like,
in studio with me tonight, author Giselle Potter. Her latest book is This Is My Dollhouse. You can also see her illustrations in the Ties column in the New York Times, the Well section. She, of course, is the author of the famous children's book, The Year I Didn't Go to School, which is adapted by Heidi Stillman, the artistic director at the Looking Glass Theater, into the show The Year I Didn't Go to School, a homemade circus, which is on stage in partnership with the Chicago Children's Theater and the Actors Gymnasium at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts until March 19th. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk some more. Sound good? All right. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking children's theater with a great pair in studio, Giselle Potter, the author of the book, The Year I Didn't Go to School. It's amazing to think that's 15 years old now. And the reason you're in Chicago is because Heidi Stillman and the Children's Theater and the Actors Gymnasium, you've co-adapted the book to put on the show, The Year I Didn't Go to School, A Homemade Circus, which is on stage at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts until March 19th. Heidi, I mean, you've done so much work. I mean, it's amazing. Look at your bio. You've been artistic director twice at the Looking Glass Theater. When a project like this comes along, and it's a little bit out of your, no, I wouldn't say it's out of your range, but it's a children's show, and you do a lot of adult theater. Mm-hmm. No, I don't want to pigeonhole you, but I mean, when you have this opportunity to have a text that is close to you, that's close to your family, is that something that you seek out?
Well, I always want to do stuff that I love, and I've been lucky enough that that's what I've been able to do. I haven't been given assignments. Because it's usually my own instigation as to what I want to adapt or direct. So, you know, this was just something that I really loved, and I had it in my mind for a long time that, oh, this would be so fun to make into a play. So, yeah, it's always kind of a little bit of a love affair with the book to want to adapt it.
Giselle, for you, you know, when you work on stories, not just the illustration, but the stories. Mm-hmm. How do stories hit you? I mean, how are you inspired by the stories that you write? Is it, I'm going to write a book, I'll figure out what it is, or is something inspire you or hit you on top of the head and be like, oh, I'm going to write about that?
Well, this book, The Year I Didn't Go to School, and the other book I talked about, it was completely just referencing my childhood and, you know, telling stories from that. And that's natural for me. Making up stories is really hard for me, and so then I think that's why I started again, because there are real life things that I was experiencing with my kids. Like, one's about if you have trouble going to sleep, what do you dream about? Just making up different ideas of what to dream about. And that was a real thing. That's a real tradition we have every night of, like, talking about what to dream about. And then This Is My Dollhouse is because of just watching them making little things. Remembering doing that when I was little, too, just how much fun it is to make things for a dollhouse more than actually play with it. And so, I mean, they're all kind of real stories. I have a lot of ideas of things that I want to write about that are not real, but they just stay as ideas.
I could be ignorant in this question, but are you ever in a situation where you would want to write a story and let somebody else illustrate it?
No. I couldn't do that. It's all about the pictures. The writing is so hard for me, and the pictures are so much more something that feels right for me.
Both of you have made a life in the arts, you know, for illustration and theater. And this play and this story is about pursuing the arts and putting some things that are normal and natural, like school, to the side to do that. Talk about what it means to be in a career in which you are pursuing the things that you went to school to do, that you even before that were inspired to be. Talk about that, about the challenges, but also just the thrills of being working professionals at the top of your game in your specific disciplines.
Well, mostly I feel so lucky. I mean, you know, it's all feels a little bit like luck sometimes to be able to do that, because it's so easy not to be. I mean, so many people I know are amazing artists and can't make a career of it, so it's sort of secondary when they have a little moment to do it, you know, on the side. And so I feel so lucky that I can do it every day. And it's just made it a really flexible lifestyle, because, you know, there's nobody telling me what hours I need to work for the most part. And I enjoy what I do. I mean, that's so lucky. Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes when people say there must be some path to get to that, I really do feel like a lot of it is just sort of happenstance and luck. It's not like, at least for what I do, and mm-hmm. I'm sure it's really different with theater, but for illustration, it's just walking into the, I mean, my career started with The New Yorker, and I feel like if that didn't happen, then maybe everything else wouldn't have happened, but I just happened to walk in the right day with the right art directors. You know what I mean? It feels like that a little bit for everything, and there's so many people that just aren't seen that are amazing artists, and they just, you know. So
I don't know if it was the story with The New Yorker, but the story I read where the ink was dripping down the...
Yes, that was The New Yorker.
So that little bit of happenstance, we got lucky that the...
It was completely because that was the first thing I ever tried to do is editorial illustration. I went to The New Yorker and you drop off a box, a portfolio box, and I, for some reason, put real paintings in the box instead of just prints, and they actually called me back and wanted to buy the paintings. I wasn't expecting, you never meet with people usually. They just take your box and leave you a note and that's it. And they actually want to meet. And I was so embarrassed because I had this blue dress that I dyed and it was raining and it was pouring down. All my legs were blue. And but I wasn't expecting at all that I was going to have this meeting. But it worked out really well. I mean, it's great. So
Heidi, ask you the same question.
Yeah, no, I feel like mine, in weird ways, it's kind of similar. Like, because I joined with Looking Glass, you know, I was... Like right at the beginning of that, I was like the year after they started, you know, and after I graduated, I got asked in. So in a way, it all was just luck in a way, you know. And who would have thought that my theater company would still be going, you know, 29 years later? So to me, I kind of feel like it was similar. Like I just kept doing what I loved, and then you know. Something grew out of it. What I love about Chicago is it's a place where an artist can have a life and can be a working artist. It's different on the coast. So I really appreciate that I've been able to have a life and have a family and keep working. Yeah, yeah. Keep making things.
Both. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, as an illustrator and a theater artist, they're similar, but they're different. But at the same time, when you think about it, the idea of conjuring up imagery and telling a story through what people see in front of them, I mean, that is at the core. That's the core of what you both do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you guys think about the idea that maybe you could venture outside of your medium? Like in some, I mean, this is kind of interesting to say an illustrator gets an adaptation or a theater artist. Do you think about, you know, are you a visual artist in the way that you could train yourself to do things in other platforms, other mediums, or are you strictly, all right, I'm an illustrator, I'm a theater artist, that's what I do?
No, absolutely. I would love to do other things than, yeah, I mean, I always say that I would love to make sets and costumes and, every, you know, all kinds of things that are still feel the same way. And it's funny because it is so similar, and I feel like a lot of times I feel like that when I'm making illustrations, that the puppetry background comes out a little bit of just telling a story that way. And I mean, I have a hard time, like I said, doing anything that's not telling a story when I'm illustrating or when I'm making pictures. So, yeah, I do think it's very similar. I don't think that it has to stay in one.
And maybe a future career in writing children's books.
I don't know. That could be cool. No, I don't know. You know, as a theater director, I get to dabble in a lot of different things, which is really fun and which keeps things interesting. And then I also have that circus passion, so I'm not doing. I wish I could, but but making. So
well, it's a tremendous book, and your illustrations are just tremendous. And it's a pleasure to meet you, Giselle Potter, the illustrator and children's book author. Her book, of course, The Year I Didn't Go to School. She's also got her new book out, which is This Is My Dollhouse, and you can find her illustrations. Was it weekly? Do you do it every week for
weekly.
The column?
Yeah,
for the Ties column in the Well section of the New York Times. And the adaptation of The Year I Didn't Go to School is on stage at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts. It's a show that's produced by Chicago Children's Theater in partnership with the Actors Gymnasium. It's called The Year I Didn't Go to School, A Homemade Circus. It's directed and co-adapted by Looking Glass Artistic Director Heidi Stillman. Heidi, pleasure to meet you. Great to have you here, and you got to come back. I mean, you're right next door.
Yeah,
right?
It's easy.
The show is on stage at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts until March 19th. Thanks for being here, guys.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
All right, it's time for Swap Meet. Greg Flam in studio. It's my favorite hour of the week. Greg, good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin.
You can find Greg at @DuPagePicker, both at Facebook and Twitter. This is the hour of the week in which we take calls and texts and evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk.
Yep.
And the more random, the better.
That's
love
right.
The text and call in. I love it, I think, because of the interaction of people being excited to sell their wares, to essentially
right.
say,
the
this
backstory,
is what I
right.
have, this is the backstory.
Yep.
It's one of my favorite things. 312-981-7200. What do you want to brag about this week, Chicago? 312-981-7200. Greg, busy week. It was a little snowy. Is that?
Yeah, a little snowy. Last weekend wasn't bad, though, as far as sales, estate sales and stuff like that. Did manage to find, I always find these Busch Crosstown Classic mugs. I brought in two of them.
This is so
and,
funny.
It's awesome, yeah. It's
May 19th, 1986.
Yeah.
They're just, were they sold at the park?
I think it was a giveaway, probably. I'm thinking it were a giveaway at the game, themselves, one of the games or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Busch Crosstown Classic, yep. Right there. It dates it.
Yep.
Busch, May 19th, 1986, Wrigley Field. And it's got two caricatures, one of Tony La Russa,
mm-hmm.
and one, it looks like Jim Fry.
Jim Fry, it looks like, yeah.
They're both, it's kind of funny because La Russa has got like some serious guns in his caricature.
Yeah, right.
Like his muscles are like protruding.
Yep.
And then Fry, they just got his frumpy old man. Like, you can tell where this is coming from. This
right.
is the White Sox.
How things
mug.
Have changed. Right.
Right.
And then I brought in the 1982 team poster I found in an estate sale. And it's kind of, you know, don't see these too much. So
yeah.
I had to pick that up. And that's the 1982 team. And Leland's a coach on that team, La Russa.
Look at that. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
cool. That's cool.
And some Vegas paraphernalia dice. You know, we had that guy called with the Capone chip, so
yes.
maybe he'll call back
Hopefully
in. But
he'll
I thought
call
I'd,
back, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I'd bring in some Vegas 50s, 60s brochures.
There was a lot
like
last week about casino chips and the things that you might, you know, have collected. There was one that was from the... I forgot what the desert...
Desert Inn. Yeah.
And then also someone called in with the chips from Al Capone casino.
So, secret
or
casino.
Or text in. And that person reached out to me on Facebook
good.
And said, oh, it's a great backstory. I'll
awesome.
Call in next week. So hopefully they will.
Cool.
312-981-7200. What do you got that you want to brag about this week? What do you want to also ask? You want what it's worth. I mean, that's the fun part too. Greg can tell you what things are going for and let people know if it's if you're holding on to something super valuable. Let's go to text right to start off. I like this one. 847 says, I have my dad's Bierstein collection from Germany.
Wow.
One has a naked woman on the inside bottom.
Yeah.
So when you finish your beer, you got something to look at.
Yeah. That's almost like the Playboy swizzle sticks that, you know, as they were cold, they stripped, I guess. Yeah.
There's never a shortage of strange tchotchkes that end up with a naked woman on it.
Right, right. No, sex sells. That's unfortunately.
Sex. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That is funny. I mean, that's like straight out of like, I think like every uncle had that cup.
Yep.
Oh, what's that?
Right.
Do a little good and drink the rest.
Yeah, they kept it on the top shelf, you know, until you're 14 and you start digging around there.
I love it. All right. I don't know what that's worth, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. 312-981-7200. We're in luck. Let's start it off, and I'm so glad that he joins us tonight. Rick is on the line. He has come through by calling into the program. Rick, how's it going, man? Thanks for calling. Tell us a little bit about the Al Capone chips.
Okay. So the story goes that back in the heyday of Chicago gambling, Al Capone's cousin, Rocco Flachetti, had this club called the Rock Guard Club, and it was in Cicero.
Okay.
And as we all know, if you're a relative of Al Capone is the one controlling it. But Rocco was the one that actually ran the club. And through his dealings at the club, he actually became friends with the late, great Frank Sinatra, who he ended up going on several trips to Cuba with. And so it was a big thing. A couple investigations shut him down in Cicero. He moved up to Lake County. more investigation, shut him down up there. He moved back to the city of Chicago, and then eventually the story ends.
Okay.
So I came in to having these chips, a coworker of mine who grew up on the South Side. When he was a kid, he worked in a wrecking yard that he knew at the time was, you know, old school mafia, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So a couple little things that he said was there was a whole pile of barrels, you know, hidden out back, and he was told never, ever to go look at them.
Wow.
Later on, you know, he got in good with the owner. The owner showed him they were full of cash.
Wow.
So money you can't spend, because as soon as you start spending it, everybody gets wise to it, right?
Wow, yeah.
So
barrel cash. No, we're familiar. Barrel cash.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, barrel cash. Everybody should have some barrel cash.
Yeah, right.
Must be nice.
So when he got a little older and was going to move on and leave the wrecking yard, I guess the guy in charge of it, you know, liked him enough and was friendly with him enough that he gave him some of these poker chips from the Rock Garden Club.
Okay.
And wow. He had quite a few of them. And, you know, he told me that at one point there was a collector in the area that actually heard that he had some. This was before the internet, so it was all word of mouth and, you know, people putting ads in the paper and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy came in and, you know, asked to see him, and he wanted to buy some. So he bought a few and then said, ha ha, gotcha. You know, these things are worth 10 times what you sold them to me for, but I got them.
Wow.
And then he pulled out a huge box out of his desk where he had hundreds of them. He says, okay, I'll remember that. Thanks.
That's
great.
Go. That's a good comeback. Well, that's good. Well, that's a good
story.
So
you have them now?
Yes. I have four of them. I don't have all of
sure.
them, obviously. But
would you be able to text in a picture of one of them or any of them?
I actually messaged Justin.
Yeah, you did. I got him on my Facebook.
Okay,
after break,
cool.
I'll take a look. Yeah. Really interesting,
yeah,
Rick.
I haven't found too much else on those particular chips. There are a lot of matchbook covers from the Rock Garden Club available.
Okay.
There's signage. Sometimes there's a brochure that pops up every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one of those things where they would change the colors frequently, like regular casinos do, because people would take the chips out today and come back later and, you know,
right.
They didn't like that. People were making copies, so there was always
right. They could
new
counterfeit,
colors
yeah.
and new schemes, right? So,
wow.
There's not too many out there. I have seen them on occasion on eBay, and I always forget to check what they end up going for. But they usually have a reserve on them, and they're at, you know, $40 or so, and the reserve's not met yet. So
yeah, I wasn't able to find any currently or in the past, like maybe 4 or 5 months. I couldn't find any.
Who
but
cares,
yeah, that's,
man?
It's a great story.
Hold on to those, because at some point or another, they A will become valuable, of course. But B, man, what a great party starter.
Yep.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, you guys want to play some?
I'm going to make them into a coffee table for my living room.
Yeah, but if you got four, sell one and go on vacation, you know, with that.
Yeah, there you go.
Rick, thanks for calling, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
All right, there you go. 312-981-7200. Shelly's on the line. We also getting a lot of texts coming in with pictures. We'll come back. Greg Flamm here playing Swap Meet. Let's take a quick break. Come back. Stay with us. It's a Swap Meet here on Download, 720 WGN. Greg Flamm in studio at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. We got a lot of great stuff coming through. Let's go to some of the calls. Let's bring in Shelly. Shelly, what do you want to brag about, Shelly?
I've got a 1969 teacup set.
Okay.
It comes with the pitcher, the sugar, the creamer, and all the seven dwarfs.
Wow.
So it's Disney.
Cute.
I'm assuming it's Disney or it's a knockoff of Disney.
Right. I'm looking up for you. But yes, tea sets have gone up with Downton Abbey. That they've just gone.
I thought you were
going to
say Beauty and the Beast.
Right. Yeah, right.
Right? They're all dancing
around. Yeah, I didn't stick to the Disney theme, but the tea sets have gone up. But Disney, I'm not sure. I'll look up and Justin can stall
while
I look up.
I like it, Shelly. I say that's cool. I like it. You get the you can get them to come alive, give them to dance around, maybe clean up the apartment.
Yeah.
I'll
have coffee.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Shelly.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I like that one. Let's keep going. Isabel. Isabel's on the line. Isabel, what do you want to brag about?
Well, I got a brick from Old Kaminsky with the whitewash, and I got it signed by Minnie Minoso.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
The story
did Minoso get in the Hall of Fame, or he missed that? Did he miss that? He missed it?
No, I think he made the Hall of Fame.
No, he's in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, he did make the Hall of Fame. That guy's great, man. What a great story. Yeah, when he died, they did a whole thing on him. Like the Obit and stuff. And I was so surprised. I didn't know a ton of stuff about him. But, you know, he doesn't get a lot of credit at all for being one of the first Latin American Latin players to be in the Major League Baseball. And there's so much, like, historical knowledge around Minnie Minoso. Does that make it worth more because he was a first?
Yeah, just the brick alone is about $80 to $100. And then you throw a signature on there. I mean, I'd have to imagine it's another 100 or two.
Did you go up to him somewhere, like at a restaurant, and be like, will you sign this?
No, actually, he was out signing at the baseball league that my son was in at when he was a kid. He came to the school that sponsored the league, and he was just, you know, and usually Minnie was always very happy, you know.
Yeah.
Because he was there every opening day, and, you know, he did all those decades. They let him play that one so he could say he was in so many decades.
Yeah, right, I remember.
He was real down that day, and he was just signing away. His head wasn't up. He wasn't looking at anybody, and we were in line. When I got up there, I plopped the brick down in front of him, and his head popped up, big old smile on his face. It was great.
He knew what it was right away. That or he thought someone was trying to assault him. One of the two.
Yeah. Brick.
Not at all.
That was smart thinking of bringing that, though. That was cool.
Isabel, thank you. That's good.
Thanks for telling me how much it's about worth.
Yeah,
about.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Good luck with that.
Bye.
Hey, I would. That's great. That's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
All right. 219 says, I have a wallet carried by my great-grandfather in the Civil War. Wow.
Yep.
First off, I got to do the short math. I'm not a math guy. But if it's your great-grandfather in the Civil War, you got to be older, right? Because you're talking grandfather, great-grandfather. Because my great-grandfather would have been World War, World War One,
yeah,
right?
Just before, yeah, around there.
I mean, great-grandfather stretch into the Civil War. That's another generation. That's a generation. Is there any way to quantify whether that's worth anything?
I'm finding them. There's quite a few of them on there. They're going for anywhere from about 60 to 140. Was that one had the extra little purse thing that was with it? That might bring it up if it's got that part to it.
I like, in this case, I think there's always one during the swap meet. And for me, this is the one you walk to the Chicago Historical Museum or the History Museum and be like, look what I got. Put this in a glass box.
The Civil War, yeah. Yep.
You know, especially if they're from this area.
Yeah, right. Especially, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's definitely something nice.
219. We'll stay on the old 219 train. I have 80 Kennedy half dollars from 1967 that have never seen the light of day.
Nice.
They're in sleeves of 20 each.
Nice. I know from a few years ago they were going for about $56 each.
What?
Yeah, I'm going to look them up now, but the pre-1956, I think, is when they lowered the silver content.
If it's before 1956.
Yeah, so if it's before, I think, 74, I think, actually, they're worth a little bit more than post-74.
It's in 1967.
Yeah, so they got a little bit more silver. So a couple years ago, I know I sold one for about $56.
$56 for a half dollar.
Yeah, half dollar.
Now, that's what I call an investment.
There you go.
You know what? I know Trump's a business guy.
Silver.
I don't know a lot about business, but he would tell you this is a good investment.
Yeah, I'll look up and see the current.
So much silver. So much silver that it's worth something, and also it's probably give you some sort of poisoning, right?
Maybe.
It's a little bit of both. Yep. I wouldn't bite on those.
No.
That would just be my thing.
That'd be bad.
That's my value I bring to this, yeah. Greg, is I give people more health tips to what to do with some of the older stuff.
That's a bad day. You're right.
Yeah. 312-981-7200. All right, let's take a quick break. Come back. Let's get the update from tonight's news with Rob Martier, and then we'll come back. I got Kurt on the line. I've got other people on the line. I've got a ton of texts. We're going to get through all of them tonight. Greg Flamm, Swap Meet, WGN.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go.
Careful, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Picking out the side again.
At DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. We are having fun tonight. It's another episode of the Swap Meet where we collectively, I guess we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. Right. And we ask you what you want to brag about. So let's get right into it. Let's go to Kurt on the line. Kurt, what do you want to brag about, Kurt?
Hey, great show, guys. I wish it was on more than once a week.
Oh, thanks.
We're working towards it.
I have this, it's a LP, a 33 and a third. It's Walt Disney's Alice in Wonderland from 1968. Mm. All the music from the Walt Disney motion picture. Okay. It's in very good to near mint condition.
Is that when the motion picture came out, 1968?
I'm not sure. That's what it says on the album, though.
Is that a bluish, purplish color?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. There's a few here. They're like in the $10 to $30 range. If yours is in like mint condition or near mint, what they call, it could be worth a little bit more.
Cool. Mm.
But, yeah, that's what you're looking at.
Well, I just, I learned something, too, Kurt, I would assume that movie came out in the late 60s.
Very cool.
We've both given each other information tonight.
Yeah, the bad news is I've seen them go as low as $3 here as well. Oh, so hopefully yours is in great condition.
Somewhere in between.
Yeah. Somewhere in between. That's right. That's how we live our lives. Thanks, Kurt.
Thank you.
All right. There's also 630's got the same concept. Are these worth anything? My sister-in-law gave them to him, albums and frames, and they're all the same kind of Lady and the Tramp, Harry, Peter Pan, Robin Hood, Pinocchio, right. Bambi, 101 Dalmatians. They're all framed. It doesn't look like they're actual albums. They're just art.
Okay. Yeah, they look like the size of a record, though. If she wants to text that or send it to the Facebook DuPage Picker, I can give her individual prices, but it's too much.
Same concept, though, right? They're going to be around the same price.
Probably.
So they wrote back, 630 wrote back saying, all original, they're all in album frames, hard to get out quickly. So I'm not even sure if the LP's in there or not, or if it's just art.
Yeah, if she just sends the picture, I'll be able to identify it by the picture.
708, let's go down here. I got a ton of stuff. Pass some of these. All right. I've got salesman samples of Christmas postcards from 219.
Nice.
And my favorite, I just opened to look at them, and they're naughty. They're like old 50s or 60s, like
right.
Mary, what does it say? It says, I don't even know. It's like, it's all like kind of, it's all sex-themed Santa Claus stuff.
Yeah.
But like in a weird, like, ooh, that's if there was any way to personify or to certain what this picture sounded like or what it looks like, it's this sound. That's it. So,
yeah,
I don't know what those are worth anything.
Yeah.
You're not finding dirty, naughty.
I don't know how to look that up. I think
somebody found Grandpa's porn collection. Yeah. Come on, man.
That's what it looks like.
That's good stuff.
Yeah.
708 says, what are two sports pennants worth? I have one very old Chicago Cardinals and one 1959 White Sox with color team picture embedded in the pennant.
Yeah, I found the picture one. It's about $100, so that's not bad.
Oh, that's not bad at all, yeah.
Yeah, the Cardinal one, I didn't find yet.
All right, well, that's good, man. $100 for the picture one. They don't make them like that anymore.
Yeah, they made a lot of pennants, but that picture one seems to be one of the higher ones.
All right. Let's go to Frank. Frank, what do you want to brag about, Frank?
I've got a George Halas's autobiography signed by him.
Wow.
Great.
Did he say something funny in it?
No, he just got his name in there. That's all. He was pretty old then. And
If you listen to the show, we always say just the signature is
probably
more than if he personalized
it. Right. He's like, Dear Frank.
Right. So that's good.
I hope you convert all your third downs, George Halas. you don't want that. Right.
Yeah, so you got that going right off the bat. What I could find, what they're going for, people are asking anywhere from 100 to 700.
Wow.
Oh, really?
And there's really hasn't been any that have sold recently, so that's not a good thing. But, I would, if you do an auction, I'd start at least
What did Dick say about Halas? Wasn't it Dick who said he throws around nickels
like
manhole?
Nickels like sewer covers. Yeah, manhole covers. Yep.
It's so good, man.
Yeah, that was a great saying. I've used that before. That's in my back pocket.
All right, Frank, that's kind of a winner.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. There you go. Frank did it the right way.
Yep.
630's got a picture of an old record machine, a manufacturer's electro home. It's that sort of modernist record player, yeah, kind of something like you'd see on Mad Men.
Right.
It's 1970-ish, and it needs a little physical cleaning.
Yeah, mid-century modern is so hot right now. And let's see, I have, they're all over, so obviously depending on condition, if it works or not, 150 to 400.
Wow.
Yeah. They also made speakers that went with it. I didn't see that in the picture
I don't
you
see
showed
the speakers
me.
In
yeah.
Here.
So if you had the speakers, you're probably in the upper 400 or 500.
It looks, I mean, there's a plug on it, so it looks like maybe it still works because it looks like it maybe be plugged into a wall.
Yeah. That stuff was great. They had the egg chairs that would match that perfectly.
Yeah. That's a cool looking thing.
It is. It's very space age.
Yeah. Very Jetsons.
Yep. Love it.
Let's go to Joseph. Joseph, what do you want to brag about, Joseph?
I was working in the DePaul area. We were remodeling a house, and just we were tearing the ceiling down, and just it looked like a $5 bill fell out.
Okay,
it had Abe Lincoln's face on it. I picked it up, and the lady said, "Well, you can have it." It turns out it's his ticket stub from the World's Fair,
wow,
the Columbian Exhibition.
Wow.
I'd be like, yeah, that's 1893, right? That's the is that the 1893 one?
Yeah, 1893.
Right. Yeah, it's a stub. It's not the whole ticket.
Sure. Is it white
it was,
on white paper?
It was in the ceiling. Huh?
Is it on white paper? You know, obviously a big five.
No,
on
it looks like a $5 bill. Which is what I thought it was because it has Abraham Lincoln's face on it. You know.
Okay.
And that's what I originally thought it was, and then I picked it up, and I was like,
yeah, I'm seeing a couple here for about $25. I'm trying to see what's actually selling.
That's it?
Yeah.
A ticket stub from the World's Fair from a
yeah,
different
I found it. It's
century?
It's got Lincoln's head
century?
On the left of it, yeah.
Is how much you say, $15?
$25.
Get out of here, man. You know what? I feel like, Joseph,
yeah.
I feel like you need to just go door-to-door on that one. I'll bet you can get 100 for it at least. Just tell the
all
story.
Right,
yeah. Let me,
all right.
Thanks, Joseph.
Thanks for calling.
That's
no problem.
$25.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
You were telling me $100 for just I don't even know what we were just talking about, where I'm like, that is worth
yeah, there's
value
no justice when a wacky pack goes for $1,000. And
Joy, who's a long-time listener who checks in regularly, she's always got good stuff. She just took a picture of an old 7-Up bottle.
Yeah.
With the old red label that says, we like it, it likes you, or something like that.
Yeah, it's got the orange background.
Yeah, how much does that go
the
for?
7. Sad to say, about $3 to $10.
If you would have told me $25, I would have lost my stuff.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right.
All right, 312-981-7200. We got some good stuff coming up here. Stay on the line, Nancy, and we'll get to the rest of the texts as well. 312-981-7200. Swap Meet. Greg Flam's here. Stay with us. Greg Flam in studio. Playing Swap Meet every Wednesday night here on the download. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Nancy. Nancy, what do you want to brag about, Nancy?
I have a Cosmopolitan magazine with Burt Reynolds as the centerfold.
Come on, that's awesome. like what years are you thinking? Like that would be like a 70s?
No, I have only one.
But I'm saying like what year did it happen?
70s, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there a fur, like a fur carpet involved?
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Is he wearing just Speedos? What's he doing?
He has nothing on.
Nothing? Oh, no. Cosmopolitan's going naked?
Okay, hold on, everyone, because Justin's going to lose his mind.
Wait a second. So Cosmopolitan's got him naked in a magazine?
Yes. Yeah.
Like Playgirl style?
Yeah, yes. I'll show you the picture.
Greg's got it on his phone.
It's going to be my screensaver now.
All right, what do you got? What's it worth?
It's and Justin's going to get mad, but it's about $20 to $45. Some
give
of them are signed upwards of $500. Sorry.
Signed? If they're signed?
If they're signed, it's like 500, obviously, but with no signature, just the whole magazine.
I know that picture, yeah. I always thought that was a joke.
No. So where would I sell it?
You know, obviously online. You can go any of the online auction sites. Start $39 plus shipping maybe, and you can work down if it doesn't sell.
Thank you.
No problem.
Wow,
good
that's
luck.
Good. That's good.
Okay,
so
bye-bye.
That's more than a ticket. Thank you.
A $5
that's more than a ticket.
than to the 1893 World's Fair.
Isn't that nuts?
A hairy, albeit hot.
Right.
I'm not going to say that Burt Reynolds was not a
right.
hot guy. Lauren just, 847, just came in. She said he was hot.
That's how you get through the Pete screening.
You get through. I also had that photo on the back of my bedroom door as a teenager.
Nice. I had the Farrah Fawcett.
I had the Alyssa Milano hockey one, yeah. So I get it. That's great, though. I have a. Would it be weird if I put that now on the back of my bedroom door? Like that picture of Burt Reynolds? Is that weird? Yeah. I don't know if it's weird. I think it's progressive.
Maybe not.
I don't know. It's very cosmopolitan.
Right.
Me.
If it's in Cosmopolitan.
All right, that's too good.
Right.
Found a bunch of old 78 size records in my parents' attic. Are they worth anything? Can I answer this one?
You can.
What are they?
Right. And
right.
Titles and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're only
artists and titles. Yeah.
It's like me going to the CD store and be like, yeah, I have a bunch of CDs.
CDs, yep.
You got to know what it's got to be. Spin Doctors.
Right.
You know, those are hot.
Right. That's nuts.
I got to sell all my Happy Mondays
yep.
CDs. Or I'm trying to think, what was the band that did I'm free to do what I want. Soup Dragons.
There you go. Yep.
I've got like 10 of those. Can I get rid of those? They still do that? They don't do that anymore.
Yep.
All right. I have a Model J38 Telegraph sending unit like you see in the movies where the tapping switch. Don't know anything about it. 708.
Yep. That is the wild card because... There was a board that went underneath the tapping. If he has that, it looks like that you're in the 200 to 300 range.
Wow.
If you just have the actual tapping unit part, it's starting at $30 and up.
Oh, so if you got the actual...
Yeah, the more accessories or more what you would call the stand, I guess, for it, would go up from there.
Let's do... is this Marla or Maria? Maria, right? Did I get it right, Maria?
You sure did.
All right, Maria, what do you want to brag about?
I have a 1976 print by Leroy Neiman of Muhammad Ali from a charity event for Chicago, I think it was Chicago Children's Hospital.
Okay.
And it's titled Red Boxers.
So it's a picture, like a print when you mean, like, so it's a photo or is it like a drawing of it?
Like a poster print,
from
the charity event.
Yeah, probably a lithograph.
But not only, it's also originally signed by both.
Wow, yeah. There's some on here with signature and the whole authentication of that, about $1,600.
Wow.
So that's pretty good. I'm trying to see if anything has sold recently.
So that...
Because it's also the last one of the lot.
No, yeah, I'd say you got something pretty good there. Can't find any sold recently, but yeah, 1500 is pretty good.
It is.
You got the artist. It's signed, and it's Muhammad Ali. So you got the trifecta going there.
There you go.
And it's the original signatures of when before he had Parkinson's. You know, so it's a nice big signature.
And it's numbered as well. So
maybe you can get together with the other guy. George, I think it was, and you can get the World's Fair ticket and just slide it in there, and you get an extra $20 on it.
Right. Maybe he'll
just come on,
he'll
man.
He'll pay the tax on it and everything for you, so you can split it.
All right. Awesome.
Thanks for
Maria.
Calling.
Okay. Thanks.
That's so true. Like,
right.
I don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm with them. Like, the idea that you're remodeling a Lincoln Park house and something falls out that's an 1893 ticket stub, you'd think it'd be more than $20.
Yep. You would.
There's stuff on here that you're talking about. You're like, yeah, well, that mug from 2008, that's about $20.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
219 says, you just brought me back to my youth. I had the same exact Alyssa Milano poster on the back of my door.
Nice.
It's classic ripped jeans. Get the ripped jeans. I think it was a New Jersey Devil.
Every week I say I'm going to get that poster for Justin because
so
it's like a dozen of them on eBay.
It's at least $20, right?
It's probably
708 says, I have a brass tag that was used as part of a keychain from a 1987 Crosstown Classic.
Oh.
It looks like a ticket stub. It's a brass tag.
Oh, I had that, yeah.
Used as part of a keychain from the 1987 Crosstown Classic.
Yep. Oh, geez.
I don't know what that's worth. It seems like it's a giveaway. Like
yeah, it was another promotional. I had that as a kid. I'm trying to find it now. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not finding it right
all
now.
All right. I mean, it seems like a promotion. I don't know if those – I would say rule of thumb for the swap meet, I feel like I'm becoming an expert, man.
You are.
You know. Promotional giveaways, not as big of a deal because it was a giveaway as opposed to something like the Muhammad Ali thing that's signed.
Right.
That's just my thought on that. Let's go to Mark. Mark, what do you want to brag about, Mark?
Hey, actually, about, I don't know, maybe like 10-plus years ago at the Salvation Army, I picked up some reel-to-reel tapes of the Milt Rosenberg show.
What?
And wow. they actually have the they have like WGN labels on them, and then all like the show info is like piped onto the label.
So does it seem like it was front-facing, like they were selling those things, or does it seem like it's from the shop?
No, from the shop.
Interesting.
Wow,
oh,
yeah.
Man.
I've come across stuff like that, too, where it's labeled. We'll have Chicago radio stations, various ones on there, and it seems like those are popping up more and more.
That's weird.
What you want to look for, okay, here's your tip of the day. When you're looking at reel-to-reel tapes, you want the ones they have the aluminum reels. The reels by themselves can get anywhere from 20.
Oh, they actually take the tape off?
Just take the tape off. It's not really worth it.
Oh, man.
Unless it's a pre-recorded one, reel-to-reel.
Are they're from his show, so they're like air checks? Or are they like raw tape?
Yeah, I found those, and also just regular people would record it, you know, just on their home unit.
No, well, these are definitely from like the station.
The station, yeah. Okay.
Wow, man. I think that the station should reach out. We should reach out and see if we can get those and play them. Right? Wouldn't that be fun to play them?
Yep.
Oh, that's cool, Mark.
Yeah,
thank
like
you.
Like I said, that's, yeah, no problem.
It's hard. Go ahead. What are you gonna say?
No, I'm just that. Yeah, they were from the 70s. I don't remember what guests were they, but I used to have a reel-to-reel player actually, and I did listen to them. But
wow. You can pick one up and check it out. But yeah, that would be fun to hear what was on it.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, sure thing.
Thank you.
That reminds me, I had a bunch of, today I went through, I was going to tell you this, like I opened up one of my old bins that I've been saying I was going to open for a while because I was looking for a picture. I have a great picture with a friend, my friend Amy, who died, and I wanted to put it up today. I found it, but I also found a bunch of other pictures and tapes and things like that. Wow. And I was like, oh, I just started to unpack, and I'm like, this stuff's great for Greg, and I'll get to it. But I found a great picture, and I want to know what it was worth, of me and Steve Dolinsky in 1998 winning a James Beard Award. There's like me getting the award. Someone took a really rocky picture. I think you barely can make out our faces. What's that worth?
$2,500.
Thank you, Rob.
There you go.
I'm in a tuxedo. It's a Genghis. It's from Genghis. There might be a cummerbund. It's kind of blocked.
$2,400 now.
And I will also say, and I'm going to put it up around James Beard time, the haircut is priceless.
I mean,
I'm going sideburns. The sideburns go almost all the way down to the cheek.
Awesome.
It's a really strong look. Really strong. Steve looks the exact same, but I do not. So, Greg Flamm, thank you so much. Another exciting and great. I mean, this is great. This is, again, like I say, one of my favorite hours of radio that we do all week, and it's a pleasure to see you. Have a good week, Pick, and you can find him at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. If you got any questions for him or you want to send him a picture of something you got, he can help you out. Greg, see you next Wednesday.
Great. Thank you, Justin.
Going to do it for the download tonight. Patty Vasquez up next. She's in studio. Hi,
I just
Patty.
Shared too much right there, didn't I?
People know
I take off the microphone covers when I come in.
That's smart.
It's spit on it all day, Justin. I'm just saying.
I didn't even think about it. And Brian Noonan was he was enraged about something today, so I'm sure he had some extra spit on this mic.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about it.
You can just take it off right now. Just go ahead and just rip it right off.
Get it
out of here. You can ask anybody if they watch the show, if they watch on WGNRadio.com, I'm always throwing it over my shoulder.
Okay.
Maybe that's why they're fuzzy, because they're picking up all the carpet fuzz. Sorry about that.
they're in disrepair. We need new mic
covers. Yeah.
What do you got? What do you got going on tonight?
We have our friends from the Irish American Heritage Center coming in. Knife and Tine is coming in. We have Wellness Wednesday. Rick Bayless coming up at after 1 o'clock.
Nice.
All craziness.
That's great. All right.
I don't know what happened. It's a lot of stuff. And Brandon Price, I think, is coming. I'm not sure if he is. I don't know what's happening.
That's good.
You do look handsome tonight. I know that you were at a funeral today.
I was at Amy Cross Rosenthal's funeral, which was tremendous. There were thousands of people at Temple Shalom up on the north side. And she produced her own funeral.
her family spoke. I would never be able to do it. Her sons and her daughters and her husband. I would just, they were so eloquent. And then she did a tremendous job of, like, there was pieces of music. We heard her voice. Like, all this stuff, because she had time, because she was, you know, she was in hospice.
Well, that's how you know she was the ultimate storyteller. She decided her own ending.
She did.
It was beautiful.
And her kids, I mean, it's amazing to know her kids for so long, but to watch them as adults get up there and be like, actually delivering, and I'm like, I'm in tears. I can't even, I wouldn't even be able to get through two lines. I'd be like, that's enough, I'm out.
Yeah.
And these kids are telling me, when my mom sent me this, my letter when my 16th birthday, and I'm going to read from it. I'm like, I got to go.
Wow. Like, well,
and they did a great job.
And so, what a testimony to her, just to, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Have a great show.
I love this. This is going to be a good evening. So be well tonight, and I will see you tomorrow.
Have a great show.
You have a great night.